Did you record that?
Did I record what?
Hello, my dear. Hello, my darling.
That's the beginning of the podcast.
Oh, really? Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm one of your wonderful, magnificent hosts, Ian Mond. I haven't had much wine yet, so I shouldn't sound too drunk. To my left, I think, is my co-host, Kirsten McDermott. And to my right is our special guest for this episode, Cameron Rogers, the author of The Music of Razors.
Hello.
How are you going, Cameron?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you doing?
Yeah, great. Okay, well, enough about you then. So, no.
I'll be right
there. So we're out here in your house. I won't say where it's located because, Kirsten, did you want to talk, by the way? Did you want to say hello?
Hello.
Yeah, because people just want to be sure that you're here.
I'm here.
Good. So here we are in your lovely place in whereabouts of Melbourne. We won't mention where because, again, I don't want all the screaming fans to come mob you at the front door. But thanks. But it's lovely. The heat is nice. The wine looks good. I've had a sip. It's quite nice. Kirsten's made a batch of gingerbread men.
The cats seem to have taken to you.
What, to Kirsten or to us?
Not
to anything
you.
Warm and bipedal, really, but yeah.
They look like they're sleeping.
The one.
She's drunk.
Oh, where's the other one? Oh, is she drunk?
It's a rather large cat, but there is just the one.
So there's Calamity and Keaton, the cats. And the gingerbread are wonderful, Kirsten. But they look really mean.
They're angry. You'd Why? Be angry if you were being eaten.
Yeah, thanks for that. They look kind of emo.
That's a quality of the humour. So, Cam, tell us something. When did the first book come out? The book come out. It's actually not your only written book. I really should just stop. When did it come out?
Razors.
Yeah, Razors.
The Music of Razors came out in 2001, but because of the sort of back-asswards way that it was conceptualized, 40,000 words of it had to be left on the editing room floor. So when Random House in New York picked it up in 2007, that's what people are calling the author preferred text, and it's, in my opinion, it's actually a better read. Also, the Australian version's out of print now, so the improved version's the only version you can get.
Even though I haven't actually read the book, I actually own both versions. That makes me a good friend, yeah?
You haven't read the book?
That makes you an excellent friend,
no.
Ian.
Either version?
No. But
get out of my house.
But let's be honest, though. What does he want? Does he want my cash, or does he want my feedback?
Well, I think he might like both.
I kind of wrote it. I kind of wrote it for it to be read.
Oh, yeah, I get that, but, you know, but, I mean...
You're a busy man, I know.
Yeah, let's not make this about me, although if we want to, that's fine. So you say there was an author-preferred text. When was that released?
Yeah, that was... was that 2007? Yeah, 2000... Maybe 2008.
So 6 years later, or roundabout.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And how did that go?
How did it go?
Yeah, or? In terms of sales and, I mean, without, you know... giving us
Oh, it's doing figures. Pretty well. I mean, Neil Gaiman said some really nice things about it, and it was enough to get me an agent in the States, which is great. And the momentum's pretty good.
So let's actually go back to the first question. How's the 2007 version doing?
Yeah, the 2007 version's doing pretty well. That's a really complicated question. It's doing really well.
Extra 40,000 words.
It's an extra 40,000 words. Well, it's not an extra 40,000 words. It's 40,000 words that should have been in there to begin with. So it makes for a better read, a more engaging read. And I think the ending's much more satisfying as well. So it's the story I wanted to tell to begin with, and I'm really incredibly proud of it.
Can I ask a rude question?
Sure.
Because I thought, you know, why not? And Kirsten, feel free to ask a question any time, you know. I mean, it's not a one-person interview here. God, so slack. First book comes out in 2001. Six years later, you do a author-preferred text in 2007. Now, I know you've done a young adult book as well in between.
Yeah, the first book I ever did was a young adult book called The Vampires, which I don't usually talk about because it's kind of freaking awful. But, you know,
so that was before 2001.
Yeah, that actually came out in 1997 with Lothian, but it was enough because it had something in print. Then it got me off Penguin's slush pile, which enabled The Music of Razors to see print.
Okay.
So it was a small break that got me my big break, and then after that, I wrote Nicholas and the Chronoporter.
See, I didn't know that. I thought Music was your first book.
Music is often referred to as my second first book.
Right.
Yeah, I think Vampires is out of print now anyway.
Collector's edition. There's always a BE book.
The question I was leading to, the rude one, was 10 years, where have you been?
Oh.
Where are the books?
No, it's a good question.
No, I'm asking this because I think...
It's a really, really good question. In fact,
I know you won't take offense.
No, in fact, seriously, I've basically had to, I've had to start from scratch in a lot of ways. And part of that was getting my site off the ground and basically going full disclosure with it because, man, this could be a really long conversation. I don't really.
It's all right. We've got wine. We're fine.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, here's the thing. I started out as a theater and an actor director, flirted with stand-up comedy. Short story is, I'm very comfortable talking. I don't really feel that I have that much to be ashamed about. And so, seriously, I mean, anybody can pretty much ask me anything and they'll get an honest answer. So when I tell you that I've pretty much had to start from the beginning, it's because when Raisers hit the first time and Neil Gaiman, you know, was good enough to read it, I mean, this is the guy who was my idol.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, like, I took so much inspiration from the guy to begin with. And it kind of blew... It made me, like, when the book was bought, there was a lot of confidence in it from the publisher. It came out to a lot of praise. And you know, one of my top three heroes of all time was actually good enough to read it, have a bit of back and forth with me, and give us a blurb that would later go on the cover. I actually thought, wow, this is really easy. And
last words.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was in 2001 that it came out.
Yeah.
And I didn't know dick about the publishing industry. I didn't know dick about maintaining career momentum. I didn't know anything about maintaining any kind of profile.
And it's before social networks, so it's not like. Because Facebook was not... Where was Facebook in 2001?
I don't think even... Well, I mean, I think it was still in Harvard, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's
certainly before...
You couldn't tweet about it and keep tweeting and keep the profile up that way. And you probably didn't have the money to run off to a bazillion conventions. I mean, things like World Fantasy Awards and stuff like that, were you aware of those things tonight?
Man, seriously, I didn't even get out of the... In fact, I got paid such a small amount. Like, the advance on Raisers was so small. It was just enough to get me airfare to London. And that was the first time I'd ever gotten out of the country. And so as far as actually going to conventions and self-promoting that way, I just didn't have the funds. In fact, I had to quit. Oh, God, that's the other thing, too. I had this god-awful job in the postal room of some company, and I had to quit in order to meet the deadline on the book. So I had no cash. Anyway, so it comes out. It does really well. I think, hey, this is easy. And then...
So it did well. It's actually sold quite a few copies.
It had a very, very small... Okay, I don't know how much I can... Oh, man. See, I don't know how I can... Okay, The Music of Rage... Oh, God.
No, Cam, it's all right, mate. Just think, you're on the couch lying here. I've got a pad and a pencil.
The thing is, I don't know how much I can actually say about this...
Publicly?
Without
no one hears
talking
this.
Out of school.
No one hears this podcast.
And stop it.
All right.
Be comfortable.
All right. The Music of Rage... The Music of Raisers was the first adult book published by Penguin's young adult department.
Okay.
And that happened because the music of Raisers started when I sent them a short story that was supposed to be the follow-up to The Vampires for Lothian.
Yeah.
And it was basically about a 200-year-old bullet removal specialist from Vermont who basically makes monsters out of people.
Okay.
And I showed it to Penguin and they said, hey, we love this character. Can you do a bunch of short stories centered around him? And I said, you do realize that even Stephen King has trouble selling short story collections, right? And so they said, no, it's fine. We feel confident in this. I said, okay, fine. So I wrote, I think it was 6 or 7 short stories based around this guy. I go, here you go. And they say, listen, the short story collections don't sell. Do you have any ideas about how we might sell this? And I said, seriously, I took 30 seconds. I had the phone up to my ear. And I said, yeah, sell it as a novel. And they said, okay, great, go to it. So flash forward, you know, a year. I've thrown out 2 of the short stories. I've slightly altered the remaining ones. I basically locked them in a room together until they've gotten along. So a kind of a context is formed for the first 4 stories.
You've done basically a fix-up novel without actually having sold short stories. So it's a fix-up novel in reverse.
I'm I realize that the term fix-up novel kind of has negative connotations.
No, no, no. Well, I don't mean it.
I think we can now call them mosaic novels.
Oh, mosaic novels. Mosaic.
It's a bit more highbrow.
I think mosaic novels is a fair term. I mean, basically, it's the kind of book I would have written anyway if they just asked me to write a novel, in the sense that, I mean, it's full of ideas. And what I really, really love about books is taking really, really unexpected elements and then just putting them, just viewing them in isolation and asking yourself what kind of context that suggests. And if it's a really exciting context, running with it.
Yeah.
And that's what I got with Raisers. So, you know, I've got a story about a 4.5-year-old kid who has a very unexpected relationship with the monster that lives in his closet. I've got the 200-year-old bullet removal specialist from Vermont. I've got an angel that was thrown out of heaven and deliberately forgotten because it was the only punishment capable of being inflicted upon a being you can't destroy. I've got, you know, a love story between a clockwork ballerina and a 2-foot-tall ogre.
Yeah, it's funny, Cameron, because the way you're describing it now, I mean, I feel bad I haven't read it. You have.
I have.
But it sounds like something that if it was released today, it'd just explode.
Well, see, this is the really annoying thing. Like, Raisers is doing okay, but it's not doing as well as everyone who's read it thinks it should do.
Yeah, okay.
And the reason for that, I think, is making people aware of it. And this is why, if you look at my site, it's camrogers.net. For the last few weeks, what I've gone from... I've written all sorts of stuff on that site, everything from misadventures in online dating through to how to make yourself a better writer through to, you know, stuff that happens to my family in rural Queensland through to... Well, what I've started writing about now is this thing I'm calling... for some reason, I've just started calling the Karma Collective, and it's basically... What I've found out is that everything seems to take care of itself once you stop worrying about yourself and start worrying more about other people.
Yep.
Now... and I've really noticed this in the last couple of months, and it's all detailed on the site, so I won't ramble on. But I'm going off on a tangent.
No, that's all right.
Sorry, but this gets
I
back
haven't fallen
this,
asleep.
This, this,
so
this gets back to what you were saying before about how in 2001 there was no social networking, that kind of thing. Now, in my experience, and I don't mean to broad stroke every writer I know here, but a lot of creatives I know seem to equate the success of friends with their own failure. So they're very covetous of the success that they have. They're very covetous of the connections they have.
Yep.
And they're very loath to be open about it, especially to people whom they see as their competition. But what I'm finding is that I've got friends who I know are very, very talented writers but haven't had a break yet.
Yep.
And so for one example is my friend Adrian Bott, who lives in Sussex, and I spent some time over there with him last year, got to actually spend some proper time with him. And the guy is a fucking genius.
Yep.
Like, honestly, he's got such a grasp on just the actual mechanics of scaring the living crap out of people.
So where is he? Why haven't I picked up a book by him?
Well, this is exactly it. So
I downloaded his RPG manual. It's
yeah.
he's a sick puppy.
Yeah.
And so how are you aware of him, Kirsten? Because you've been speaking to Cameron.
Yeah.
You talk to have spoken independently of me.
I read his live journal, but I've switched to reading a blog directly.
Yeah, I hardly touch the LJ anymore. Everything's on the blog on the website now. But
so he has got something out there in the real world.
He's got something out there. He's written. He's actually been writing for probably 20 years now.
Yeah,
and it's in the role playing industry. He's written some seminal works. And it's the thing is the stuff that he writes. Most of it is like color text and filler text and fiction for a lot of the supplements.
So that's it's the sort of stuff you'd find on a gaming card. The little
no. It's actually full on like short stories backing up, say, you know, monsters and stuff like that. Anyway. He's got a brilliant grasp of rural horror. Anyway, he hasn't had a proper break with a proper publisher. And so when this other project came along with the publisher, see, I can't even talk about it, so I'm talking in circles here. But there's a collection that's coming out next year.
You introduced him to an editor.
I introduced him to an editor who's a good friend of mine who had a project on the boil. There was a vacancy in that project, and I suggested Adrian... this editor friend of mine took a look at Adrian's... In fact, the same role-playing supplement that Kirsten looked at, was completely blown away by it. Got Adrian to come up with some stuff for this new project, and it was the talk of the building. And seriously, I think...
Really?
Yeah. And just as the vampires was a tiny little thing that I wrote in 1997, but it was done with a known publisher, and that was enough to get my to get me off the slush pile.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that this publication in a project by a major publisher will be enough to get Adrian noticed, because if he does a book, I think it'll be really noteworthy.
Okay.
And so, getting... Sorry.
Yeah. No, no, that's, no, that's fine. Fine. I just... To get back to you, yeah. not that, you know, I mean, we'll invite Adrian another time from Sussex, fly him down into a ride with the Critic.
We can go to the UK.
Yeah, well, that'd be great.
We're going to go to Tasmania next year.
We are?
Oh, yeah. I already talked to your wife. She's cool.
Yeah, whatever. yeah, I think that was as long as she could come with. Can we get to the thing,
yeah,
please? I don't even know what I was going to ask.
Was it about promotion or something?
Well, I am sort of, yeah. That's one of the things that gets me, because I come back, 1997, 2001, you're lucky to get the 2007 happening.
Yep. Okay.
But it's there's so many years between. I mean, fuck it. Why would you even bother? I know you can write. I mean, I haven't read your book, but Curzon says you can, so I'll trust her. you have talent, but why wouldn't you just say, fuck it, it's not for me anymore?
Well, this is the thing. I think that was a part of it. See, this is the thing. Like, so it came out in 2001. I had no way of promoting myself. I didn't know the first thing about it, and I certainly don't have a head for business. It's only something I'm slowly starting to understand now. So it comes along in 2001, and it basically... Oh, yeah. So it's the first adult book published by the Young Adult Department, because it was solicited as a short story collection by the Young Adult Department.
Yeah.
Then it becomes a novel, and they realize we can't sell this to kids. But because
they
of
tried.
The way, yeah, they tried. But because they didn't tell the booksellers that it was an adult book, it wound up being shelved in the children's section. And the first 3 weeks of a book's life is freaking critical. And for the first 3 weeks, I had to run around bookstores, yanking it off shelves and putting it into the adult section myself. And then the staff would go and put it back in the kids section anyway. So it wasn't until 5 or 6 years later that the editor in charge actually kind of shamefacedly admitted that, you know, I'm sorry, we killed your book.
Like, so you were lucky to get a second chance then?
I was freakishly lucky in the sense that not only in the sense that it got a second lease on life, but it was also the version that was meant to be printed in the first place. So,
but again, someone would say that's 4 years ago. Where's the 4 year contract with one book every year?
Oh my god!
I'm asking.
No, it's a really good point.
Just assume that. Look, these are the questions I always think.
It's a modern paradigm that I don't agree with the book of the year, the 2 books a year as they're coming out. I mean,
we've just had Steph Swainston.
It's killing writers.
Steph Swainston has decided.
Yeah, she's going back. She's going to go back and teach high school chemistry.
She can't keep up with one book a year.
That's more fun.
Oh my god!
They're doing the one book a year.
Yeah, I've got friends who've basically given up to become botanists, like, because they just couldn't be asked competing in this industry.
Yeah, I get that. Okay, fine. So Cam, he's an artiste, and he's not going to do the one book a year because he's an artiste.
Well, actually, my agent is saying I have to do the book a year, and I think he's got a point. Unfortunately. If you're looking at traditional publishing.
But you're derailing me on purpose, Kirsten. I'm asking, where's the contract for that anyway? Whether you want to do one book a year or not, where 2008 comes along, the book you say is doing well, why hasn't... Is it Random House who did the 2007?
It's Ballantine, which is an imprint of Random House, yeah.
Hi, Cam's agent. Love the book. Where's the next one? Where's the sequel? Or if not a sequel, where's a new series? Where is it?
Okay.
If you don't want to answer, that's fine. I will not never speak to you again.
You're
pink.
It's okay. Saying life got in the way.
It's getting really uncomfortable with this conversation. Kirsten, should I be asking
you're
these questions?
Bullying,
to you?
I guess.
No, seriously. I'm just trying. The thing is, like, I've been listening.
I think there's a word for there's a one word answer to that question. Actually, that's probably fateless.
Oh my god, you're absolutely right. Well, actually, yeah. There is, and again, you can read all about it on my site. But the short story, yeah, fateless.
Oh, this is the book that wouldn't die.
Oh, my God.
Well, you don't have to talk about Cam. If it's going to make you cry, you don't have to talk about
it. No. It's just it's a case of realizing that we've only got 2 hours.
Jonathan Strahan.
Yeah, no, Jonathan Strahan.
Who will be listening to this one.
Yes, so. Although he's probably already fallen asleep.
Okay, the capsule summary is this. The reason the Razor's got a second lease on life very, very quickly is largely due to Kirsten. And I've told you this before, and I know you don't believe me, but Kirsten was good enough to get me a slot chairing a panel at Continuum 4. Was it 4?
Anyway,
it was Neil Gaiman and Robin Hall.
Continuum 3. I was continuing for better convention than hers. But anyway, yep.
But anyway, as a result of that, I wound up running into KJ Bishop. KJ Bishop had read my book, said, "I really love your book. Who's representing you in the States?" I said, "Nobody." She said, "You should have my agent." I got her agent, and then Razors got sold overseas. So that wouldn't have happened if you hadn't been good enough to get me that. Which gets back to what I was saying before about artists helping each other out. Blah, blah, blah. So the book saw print second time in 2007. Now, there was a... Okay, in 1994...
Oh, my God.
In 1994... Okay, yeah. I've been writing books since I was in the first grade. Like, the first business I ever ran was writing books to spec for my classmates.
Yeah.
That's when I realized that everything takes three times longer than you
expect. In 1994, you were young, man.
No, this is 1978. Anyway.
Oh, don't tell them your age. Anyway, yeah.
Ah, whatever, I'm adorable. So, And anyway, in 1994, I basically wound up renting Cronenberg's adaptation of Naked Lunch on VHS.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it just kicked off something in my head. I wound up writing down like two pages of notes, and suddenly I had this schematic for a novel that I just realized was the best thing I was ever going to think of, and that if I could write this book and if I could get it in print, then I will have achieved the goal of my life, and if I got hit by a bus the day after, then I'd be fine with that. So basically, I became a host organism for this fucking book.
And now, this book is not Razors.
No,
this is a book called Fateless.
Fateless has been in your head for 17 years.
Fateless has been in my head for 17 years. And I've written it from word one three times over now.
Have you ever thought of writing a book about a book that's stuck in your head for 17 years?
Oh, that's so
driving an author's... Well...
I don't know, didn't Stephen King corner the market on that?
Yeah, he probably did. It's a bit cliche now. But so you've written it three times over. How long was each manuscript?
The first one, when it was called A Needing Kind, was about 120,000 words. The second one was 100, and the third one is 120.
And it's Christ. Now dead.
Here's the thing.
There's a 4-3 ride in the works.
Here's the thing. I wrote... that fucking book. The third iteration took 7 years. The third iteration took seven fucking years.
Without going into too much detail, it's got World War One stuff in it.
It's got World War One. It's got prehistoric Pakistan. It's got, well, not...
When you think of prehistory, you're thinking of Pakistan.
No, I don't... Okay, not dinosaurs, but, you know, human culture, ancient culture. It's got the killing fields of World War One. It's got modern day Melbourne.
So you had to do quite a bit of research. It wasn't just one of those, "Oh, I'll just pull this out of my ass."
And that's part of the problem. Yeah. Part of it is getting trapped by research.
Yeah.
Part of it is getting sucked into what they call sunk cost fallacy.
Yeah.
Which is basically
so much time already.
Yeah, exactly. I've spent so long doing this that if I quit now, I've wasted all that time. Therefore, I'm going to spend more time on it so that I don't waste all that time.
Yeah.
And 18 years later, you're still working on it.
Yeah.
Is that
actually a thing called sunk cost?
Sunk cost fallacy.
Wow.
Yeah, seriously.
Come up with a fucking name for
it. The more money, the more time, okay. the more you invest in something.
Yeah, I got the theory. You didn't have to explain it again.
Okay. Oh, my God, you're so rude.
I'm not rude. Don't patronize our audience, me being the audience. Yes.
Anyway,
I was patronizing you.
So anyway, 7 years in, I write this thing, I show it to people, people really love it, but with a whole bunch of buts.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I am now so close to this thing and have been for so long that I have absolutely no perspective on what it looks like. I cannot get any kind of topographical grasp of how this thing looks to somebody who's reading it for the first time. So I wind up becoming reliant on my friends to read it. And then I'm like a blind guy asking people to explain it, to describe an art gallery to me. You know, and then the metaphor is breaking down. But you get the idea. And honestly, seriously, it cycled into, I'm going to give you another term, learned helplessness, where basically everything just ends in failure, so you just suck it up. And I was just basically turning up to the keyboard every day, unable to get excited about anything on the page, even though I knew that some of it was really, really good. So the short story now is that if I could have handed the book to somebody, to a clone of myself who had never seen it, he could have made a kick-ass book out of it. Instead, what I'm doing now is I'm cannibalizing the good bits out of it, and I'm using it in other books.
Okay. You know, you still haven't answered the question I asked.
Which was
what? What was the question?
You've avoided it like the plague. And that's fair, but I'm disappointed.
No, I'm not avoiding it.
Where is the fucking contract from 2008?
Give us another fucking book. Oh, right.
I don't give a shit. Fateless, whatever. 17 years.
Oh, no, there's a really simple...
There is not simple. We've just spent 15 minutes. I haven't got anything out of you. Where is the contract?
there is a really simple answer to that. That is, I was offered a 3-book contract.
Oh, you could have said that 10 minutes ago. Really?
Yeah, I was offered a 3-book contract, and my agent turned it down.
That's not never a good sign.
No, my agent turned it down because he... And this was a really smart fucking move on his part. Because he didn't want he didn't want too much pressure on me. Because, see, the temptation is like, you know, you get a big paycheck, you get three books, you get paid in advance, that's all fine and dandy, and then you've got to write the damn
thing.
My point is, Ballantine and Random House are still interested in seeing whatever I come up with next, and that's great, but they're going to pay me when it turns up. And frankly, that's better for me.
Okay, better for you maybe psychologically.
Definitely. Well, that's
But as an artist...
Wait, artist is... Hang on. What? How? You can't separate psychology from the work.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right. That's true. Okay, fine. It's my Jewish heritage coming out here, so just mind me. But if I was offered a three-book contract, even though, yes, there's caveats, et cetera, placed on it, to me would be, well, at least I'm getting my name on three books. And yes, I'll have to discipline myself.
You're only getting your name on three books if you write those three books.
Yeah, but like, this is that's what you're in the game for, isn't it? I mean, you're in the game to write the three books. Am I being really naive here about artists?
No, you're not being really naive. It's just that... Look, you know what? I dare say everybody's experience of getting that first contract and what happens afterwards is probably very different based on what it's like living inside your
Kirsten?
Head.
You got a two-book contract, right? Did you not?
Yes, I did.
And?
And I'm finishing the second book now. Thank you very much.
Yes, but... So you had a different reaction, though. You didn't turn it down. Well, you already had the first book written, though.
The first book was written, and I had a start on the second and a synopsis, which is... bearing little resemblance to what's now on my word processor. Hello, publisher. So it seemed like it would be fairly easy to get that turned over, but that's not what happened. So now I have a tight deadline that I'm working very hard to make, and it'd be nice to have more time. On the other hand... how much more time do I need? Do I need another year? Do I need another 5 years?
Well, I'm not trying to make a judgment call that Kirsten, I'm just, getting the contract up front is right or doing what you're doing.
Kirsten is more of an adult.
Okay. The point, Cameron, is that you finished the book and it's called Fatalist Mark 2 because it's got nothing to do with that.
Mark 3,
Mark 3, Mark 8, whatever. And you put it in and then because the publishing industry changes every 20 minutes and because global financial crisis, yada, 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 everyone goes, yeah, we're not interested anymore, sorry.
Sorry, you've lost me. What?
But they say we're not interested.
Who says this?
Ballantine, Random, whoever the hell it is
When
you finish
what,
it.
What if? He's saying
that
is a risk you're willing to take.
Yeah.
Because you've spent 17 years, forget the when, book, you've had your brain around writing for 17 years and you're thinking, fuck it. Let's see.
The headspace I was in when Razors saw print, because you got to understand I was also living with Fateless.
Yeah.
I was right in the middle of Fateless at the same time that saw print as well. Like, the mental exhaustion was, at the risk of sounding like a freaking pansy, but the mental exhaustion was so intense. Like, the creative well was so dry. It actually hurt like cracked, inflamed skin. Like, I would turn up to the page and I could not think of a fresh idea that excited me. I couldn't even think of a slightly interesting turn of phrase. Like, every day I would turn up and I wasn't even running on fumes. Like, I was just so burnt out. In hindsight, even at the time, I knew my agent was doing the right thing and I didn't even fight him on it. It was like, if I'd gotten a 3-book deal, I would have been screwed at that point. Okay. Now I could probably do it in my sleep. But then I was a very different person.
No, I understand. Look, I just care for you, Cameron.
Look, I mean, the only thing worse, I think.
And so does Brendan, by the way. I'll just mention him. You know,
Brendan Kaufman.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm having beers with him on Friday.
Are you really? Mm. Oh, great. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, let's do that.
I was going to say, the only thing possibly worse than turning down a 3-book contract is accepting a 3-book contract and failing to deliver.
Yeah, I think we both know somebody who was in that position.
You're going to find it much, much.
Do you actually genuinely know someone who was in that position?
Yeah. And I don't want to be in that position.
Yeah, look, we'll move on now to the books because this has been half an hour.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, Jonathan's already. And Jonathan, who knows that we're reviewing Eclipse 4, is going, get to my fucking book. Although, to be fair, he could just skip all
ahead.
This and because you're going to put the times in.
There will be times in the show
yeah,
notes.
Yeah, so. And that's what he'll probably do. What you're saying, though, is going... Because we've got a lot of wannabe writers, and not that this is a writing show, but we've got a lot of wannabe writers and writers who do listen to this, and this will... What you're saying will have, resonance with them, I would think, because there are people in the... Have had similar experiences or... Yeah.
Well, part of what I'm trying to do with the site and the reason for getting the site up is because I know that, and again, it seems like there's a lot of talk about technique and blah blah blah, but there's no one's actually talking a lot about the time they fell on their face.
Yeah, I could see why that would be important. And I think when you go to like a Clarion West or in America, they do that 6-week course, and I think part of that 6 week is to discuss how fucking tough it can be.
Yeah.
To be a writer, forget just getting the words out, just living as a writer.
You got to understand that, like, my experience, like, I mean, seriously, I just wasn't equipped as a person or discipline-wise to be in that position at that time.
There's more support now, said, though, but like, there wasn't support in 2001.
Oh, look, there was no support, and I was in the middle of, like, a massive dry spell. Like I said, I was a very different person at that point. I had a lot of growing up to do, so Kirsten is in a much better position to take, you know, something like that on.
We're calling Kirsten grown up.
He doesn't
She's
know
very
well.
Diplomatic. But
anyway, so what's the website? You want to finish? No, I'm going to cut you off.
Yeah, you can get to it at camroges.net. That's CamRoges.
We'll have a link to that.
Yeah, we will. But it's but
there's articles on the whole Fateless thing. There's articles on craft technique. There's articles on writers supporting writers, basically.
Now, Cameron, what book did you recommend for us to read?
World War Z by...
Call it by its proper title.
American book, World War Z.
Yeah, it's World War Z.
Ian got told off.
Max Brooks. It was...
And why did you choose for us to read
Because
that?
It was one of the... Oh, man. It was one of the most fun reads I've had in a really long time. I read it maybe 3 years ago now, but... One of the things, like I was saying before about getting a bunch of ideas and locking them in a room, one of the things I really, really, really loved about this book was it was a fantastic example of what if, of really, really taking a lot of joy in just exploring a really, really interesting what if.
Okay.
And so basically, and this gets back to the whole research thing as well. You can tell that Max Brooks really, really, really dug researching things like, how does a military unit operate? What happens to a pilot when he bails out and he's in the middle of nowhere? Like, what's the routines that they go through? How does the UN operate? What do they do if this happens? What do they do if that happens? Then applying it to the single scenario of what if there was a zombie outbreak?
Yep.
And then it's a collection of just the most fascinating, fun, entertaining, human, moving stories that, by and large, actually aren't about zombies. It's just about, it's largely about people at their best while going through their worst as this fucked up playground kind of disintegrates around them, explored through all of these facets. And you can tell he just got to go absolutely berserk with research and really, really enjoy it. And so watching him extrapolate a potential outcome from this particular kind of Holocaust based in fact, in the way that people and organizations actually work, was fascinating. Because it's actually like, oh yeah, it could actually work like that. And so it was like actually being able to be there.
So Cam, here's the problem though. Every time we've had a guest on, every book they've recommended, we've eviscerated.
Go for it.
It's been like the kiss of death.
And to be frank, this might occur with your book.
That's okay.
I just want you to know that because I don't want you to weep. Okay? And it's not you. It's us. It really is us.
Actually, that's not true because I liked Embassy Town.
Oh, that's right. You did too. Stupid woman. Oh, my God. That's such a bad thing to say. Oh, I'm in trouble again. No, if you haven't got up to episode 8 yet, Cam, we had a major tiff over Embassy Town. So, yeah, I suppose that does break the cycle. No, good. Well said, Kirsten. Good point. Well made.
Thank you.
Actually, for me, I'm not speaking for her, World War Z passed the train in the morning test. The tram in the morning test. If a book can keep me awake on the tram for the 30-minute journey, it must be doing something right.
Bloody hell, the MX would keep me awake on the tram for 30 minutes.
Really? Yeah, but I mean, the MX is oh, yeah, but it's got to have something going for it. And MX, of course, you know, it's got beautiful pictures. It's got big, bright pictures. People don't know what we're talking about when we say MX.
It's the free transit newspaper, which is just full of gossip about what people are saying on Twitter.
Yeah, I think most countries have them now, don't they?
Yeah, I think so.
In fact, I don't think we invented it either. Anywho, with World War Z, yeah, it kept me going. It did keep me going, but I noticed the thing that Kirsten's going to discuss as well. Can I mention it?
No.
Okay. So,
what I'm going to say is I found it really interesting because I read this book not long after it first came out.
Mm.
So, it was published in 2006, so I probably read it 2007, something like that. Actually, I think Ian recommended it to me, or someone recommended it.
Because I hadn't read it until...
Whatever. I found it. I read it.
Thanks.
And I remember liking it so much so that I think it survived my book cull, even though I can't find it. I've lent it to someone who can keep it. Hello, if you've got my World War Z, you may have that book. Because I reread it, just wanting to kind of refresh myself with, you know, what story there was. And I don't know whether it's just I have changed or it just does not stand up to a second reading, because I was bored in a lot of areas. And angry in others.
Angry, really? I can see how it may not stand up for a second reading.
When we drove here to your place and she was giving me directions,
that's a bit of a rant.
She was also ranting. I said, leave it for the fucking podcast, Kirsten. She said, I have to get it out.
No. I want to know. Like, I can't imagine what parts of it would have been.
No, we're not going to tell you, Cam. We're just going to keep it to ourselves.
Can I?
Yes, she'll tell you.
The listeners will not see, but can I show you my spreadsheet?
Right.
This is my spreadsheet.
A spreadsheet of what?
Of World War Z. Of the characters.
Oh, Jesus God, you really did hate it.
Oh, yeah. I hated it enough to get out Excel.
Oh, my God. Okay, I've got to hear this.
So what we have in World War Z are 44 characters with a voice, including
short stories,
the narrator.
Basically. Yeah.
Right, so you have the narrator and you have 43 people he interviews.
Uh-huh.
There are five women.
Women. I knew you were going to say that.
Not only are there only five women in a book that is meant to, and actually fails quite miserably at providing a social history of the zombie war, but four out of those five women have their femininity well grounded from pretty much the first sentence they're introduced, by which I mean the first woman we have who comes about 12 in.
And can I just say, before you go on, I noticed it too. I don't know if it's all this gender stuff that's going on. Galactic Suburbia, thank you very much. But I actually said, when's there going to be a woman voice in this?
Yeah, there's no woman at all in actually the first section. The first section, which is pre-war stuff, or as the outbreak begins, there's no female voice at all. The first woman we get is Mary Jo Miller, who is... and it's actually funny because on the way here, Ian was saying, yeah, wasn't she the wife and the mother or something with the kids?
I called her the yuppie wife.
She was actually the mayor of one of the new townships that was developed. The reason why you don't get that she's the mayor and why that doesn't carry with you is that she's introduced with two or three answers to questions which situate her as a wife and a mother who's worried about her husband and her job and her kids and shopping. And there's this great line that says he asked her about the news and didn't she know what was happening. And she says, oh, why would I want to get depressed by watching TV? I could do that just by stepping on the scales every morning.
Yeah, I mean,
because, you know, women
like
are obsessed with their
weight.
She's
the Real Housewives cliche.
And then, of course, she gets, at the end of the novel, you have some snippets from people in the goodbyes section, and she gets to be revisited. She's actually called Mrs. Miller. She's not even called by her name.
She's
situated by the wife of her husband. She's not even Mayor Miller. She's Mrs. Miller. It actually took me a second to remember who she was, because she's not even Mayor Miller or Mary Jo, which all the men are called by their first name or given the honorific if they're a general or something. She's Mrs. Miller. I got so mad. Then you have Sharon... And I will quote this. Sharon is infantilized and sexualized in the same way. It's actually very clever.
Sorry, refresh my memory. Which one was Sharon?
Oh, you probably won't remember her. Because she's the tricky thing that Max Brooks thought he could do to bring a childlike voice to the novel. Because you can't do that. Because the novel, of course, is set 10 years after the zombie wars.
Yes.
And anyone who was a kid is now, very least, a teenager or a young adult. But he wanted a child's voice.
This is the one who is brutal, who is like so brutalized she never actually matured.
Here is her description. Let me read. Here is her description. Sharon could be considered beautiful by almost any standard, with long red hair, sparkling green eyes, and the body of a dancer or a pre-war supermodel. She also has the mind of a four-year-old girl. So she's sexualized and infantilized in the same introductory paragraph, which is actually amazing work.
I have to say, though, that was a harrowing chapter, though. It really was. I know what you're saying. I know you're right. And I know it's really, really manipulative. But
anyway, moving on. Because there are a lot of harrowing chapters. The next one we get is Maria Zhuganova, who is a Russian. At the time, she was in the Russian military. The first time we see her at the beginning of the book, she's recounting her experiences with the zombies and so on. She's introduced with a physical description of her face being worn, her hair graying, her body straining the seams of the fraying uniform.
Uh-huh.
again, the men don't get these descriptions. The men are situated. I think there's two cases in the men where they're given a physical description, and it's
really. I could have sworn there was like, you know, paunchy good old boys, and
there's not a lot of physical description, and
there isn't.
The men are situated within their jobs, within their positions of power. Right. Anyway, so Maria. Yeah, and there's a line in here where she's talking about, and she's, you know, she's in a military outfit, and she talks about one of her close friends in the outfit who is a gunner, and she said, "We were friends because he kept the other men away from me, if you understand what I mean."
Can I say something? I didn't even know she was a woman until that bit.
Yeah.
But
she was introduced.
No, I know. But I actually...
You skipped the introduction.
No, I didn't skip them, but they didn't really... anyway. Because they're written in such... they're written in such a passive voice. Mm-hmm. That some of them didn't seep in. So I thought she was a male until that bit.
Right. To put this...
What in, happens no, with no, Maria, though, at the very end, she also gets a goodbye section at the very end. And then she's revealed to actually... The reason her suit is like splitting at the seams because she's actually pregnant with her eighth child, and she's been forced to repopulate Russia, so to speak, along with however many other women.
Yes, that's right.
By men she doesn't know. The children then get taken away. Yeah. So she's basically this brood mare.
Yeah.
That's the reason she's a female. So then she could be this big reveal that she's actually a brood mare for Russia.
Yeah.
You have Christina, who is again... She was the one who was shot down. She was a pilot.
Yep, yep.
And again, she's introduced. Her long black bangs and delicate facial features only reinforce the picture of eternal youth. Then she removes her sunglasses and I see the fire behind her eyes. So again, you have this woman who's, you know, situated within her sexuality and her look. She's almost infantilized again as a way of getting around the fact that she's actually kind of a kick-ass pilot.
Okay. I've got to ask, and the reason I'm asking, are you sure any of the guys didn't get like the Chinese people
couple?
In the first chapter and stuff? The reason I'm asking that is like I said before we started casting this pod was I read this book 3 years ago. I haven't read it since.
Yeah, back down now, Cameron.
Because my grasp of the details are a bit gone. And like you, maybe I was a different person then. But
yeah.
I still think it's a good book. But I listened to the audiobook 3 weeks ago and I skimmed through it 3 days ago.
The audiobook's quite abridged though.
It's abridged in that, well, a few chapters are missing.
Yeah.
But I could have sworn that... Particularly in the beginning when they're setting up the scene in the Chinese village and all that other stuff.
There are a couple of guys. I forget which one. One is the lecturer. He's described as quite handsome or something. And the line is used like something like, so naturally many of his female students have a crush on him.
Oh,
so
right.
Even when the men are physically described, it's from a different vantage. It's from a position of using their physicality again as part of their power, whereas the women's physicality is used as... a way that they're observed.
See, okay, this is really...
And it just got me angrier and angrier.
just
and that's only the voiced characters, too. Because you have women in the background.
Yeah, but this is just a quick anecdote. First time I read it, didn't have a problem with it. First time you read it, didn't have a problem with it.
Mm.
First time a friend of mine, who's the most hardcore militant feminist I've ever known, she couldn't put it down. She loved it to death. But I'd be curious to know what she would think if she read it a second time.
I don't think it's... I think the novelty of the book, the fact that it's a mosaic novel, the fact that you have these interviews with people and that's the way it's presented, I think that kind of drags you along.
Yeah.
And a second reading when you know... And I couldn't remember everything, but it's like, oh, yeah, this is the bit with the submarine. Oh, this is the bit where that happens.
Well, yeah, you've got time to see the seams the second time.
Yeah.
Around,
maybe. Five years ago, I wouldn't have noticed it, but because I've been made more aware of gender issues, as I said, on the tram while I was wide awake reading it, I was waiting for the first female voice. Even though, but when it did occur, though, I didn't get the same.
Yeah.
You know, although I should have
except
picked
you thought she was a yuppie housewife.
Yeah.
She's the mayor. She's the first mayor of this new town that's been built. What you take away from it. Is she's this yuppie spoiled housewife because that's where she's situated in the book.
But you're 100% correct. You are a bazillion percent correct. And I'd actually be interested to see what your... Do we really want to call her a militant feminist friend? Can't we just call her by her name? Or what's her name?
No, let's not call her by her name.
No,
she's
not
here.
Drop names.
Well, all right, fine. But we dropped Brendan's name. But anyway, no. I'd be interested for her to listen to the podcast. Mm. Seriously, not to get an extra listen, although that's always great. But, just to hear what she thinks about, just to get her feedback on what she thinks of what Kirsten has said.
I read it, and I was telling her at the time what a great read I thought it was. And her take was, I hate zombies. Like, I just hate, she just hates it. Picked it up anyway and couldn't, hate zombies. I read it.
I remember reading it really quickly the first time.
I chewed through it. I didn't want it to end when I first read it.
I think Kirsten's right. The mosaic. I think it's the second reading. It was Campbell Kirsten. The mosaic. The novelty. The mosaic.
The novelty. I think drags
is
through.
What. Yeah, yeah. Gets definitely.
And the second reading, you realise actually the voices aren't great. Mm. They're actually
Oh, don't take my point.
They're incomplete. They're not good interview voices. You have people doing things in a verbal interview that are like with lengthy quotes and things from people, and it's not he said this blah blah blah. It's not like and he said something like it. The voices aren't the voices of oral interviews, and whether that's because the interviewer character has tidied them up or something, or gone and fact checked and put in quotes. I don't know, but it's presented as
but
transcription.
There's poetic license there.
There is, but.
Can I just say, for me, the biggest problem, aside from the gender issue, which I noticed, but it didn't get beyond...
I just got very angry.
It just was a note. It was a note rather than an anger, was that the other cultures, and we get a lot of China, we get India, and we get others, basically sound like Americans. Now, I understand the argument that the narrator has probably cleaned it up and made it a translation issue as well, but it shat me because you really couldn't just, aside from the fact that they talk about their cultures from a interview style thingamajig, you couldn't actually identify them as anything but people who live in America or the Western world. And that annoyed me.
But I think there's a translation.
No, I think there's an issue there.
I think there's
part of
that.
This is
a book that has been valorized for providing a global perspective.
Yeah, and I'm now unvalorizing it by saying.
Yeah, and I don't think
something?
It does actually.
But
provide
to be fair, from memory, the characters that he's talking to are either educated or very well-to-do, elevated sort of.
Potentially, that makes
figures.
It worse. But so what? That implies that an educated Indian is somehow more Western than a non-educated Indian.
Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was Western educated. Like. There is a kind of a homogeneity once you hit a certain level of education and income. This is a UN. What was he? Not
he's
a diplomat.
He's a fact finder.
Fact finder
for the UN.
He wants to write a history about the narrator. Yeah. He's not a narrator. He's the interviewer.
Yeah, and so these key people were positioned at certain
he
burst
doesn't
points
narrate,
because they were there were other very highly trained specialists or military commanders or
there are a lot of ordinary people.
Yeah, there are
on
and
the ground.
Even
yeah,
right,
but
Cam.
A lot of the ordinary people from memory were all kind of American. A lot were.
And it's interesting, and I can see why he did it, why he made, because the book's broken up into a number of sections, and one of the main sections is literally what happened in the US. So there's a whole middle of the book is devoted to the war in the US, and then it goes and looks at other countries in the next section. But and I know why he did that, A, because it's a US novel, it's published in the US, and B, because there is this thing about the US being at the head of this stuff, and they would be the ones, I suppose, who would be pushing to win the war. Because, I mean, the idea, there's a bit of the US rah-rah-rah in it, that they win the war and then they go and help everyone else.
They're the one pushing to actually go on the offensive against the zombies.
The president gets up. The president gets up who's not Bush, but we don't know who he is.
That's a black president.
Yeah, he gets...
Which is interesting, considering it was written in 2006.
Correct. And by the way, Mr. Brooks, we're not saying you're racist. Anyway, but
no, where did
sexist.
That come from? I'm just saying it's interesting that he has a black president in the book when
No, based on my point that they all sound the same.
I think it was prescient.
But he gets up and he does the rah-rah-rah, we've got to fight speech, and then shoots himself or something.
No, he dies. No, he just dies.
No,
he doesn't do a rah-rah. What are you talking about?
He does.
When
he gets in front
book?
Of the... I read it maybe 60... No, I read it on the tram, I told you.
He didn't shoot himself. What are you talking about?
He doesn't shoot himself. You're right. He does die, though, because of the stress slash...
Yeah, exactly.
Issues of it all, but
that's quite a difference.
I had a point. My point is that for a book that is valorized for being this global exploration of the zombie war, everyone sounds the fucking same. And the only people who don't sound the same, and see, I'd be okay with your translation point if everyone did actually sound the same, but there are people who don't sound the same. And guess what those people are? They're all the people who live in America. They're distinguished. There's the southern guy, the Republican.
Actually really funny because being Australian, there is one Australian character in the book who's the guy who was up in the International Space Station. And it's really funny because I'm reading his section and he references that Red Gum song, Sunny Night.
I was going to mention that.
Oh, that's how we know he's an Aussie. And I'm wondering if the...
But no, the Americans wouldn't get that. The Americans would never have heard of that song.
Yeah, but it's just, it's like, I don't know.
It's annoying. For me, it was annoying. For me, for a global book, it needs to sound global, and it didn't sound global. They may as well all lived in the same town. Right.
Just playing devil's advocate. I'm not saying...
Well, you recommended the books.
No. Just about the voice thing. A lot of writers have problems making sure their characters don't sound like each other. Do you know what I'm saying?
Differentiating
their voices can be a really tricky feat of technique that a lot of writers have trouble with.
And Max hasn't succeeded. And I think he's, and to be fair to him, writing for the other, right, you know, because he's obviously a white American, yes?
Yeah.
Mm. So he's writing for the Chinese,
yeah,
writing
Mel
for the
Brooks's
Indian.
He's son, right?
Sorry?
He's Mel Brooks's
is
son.
Is he?
You're joking, really?
Son
I didn't
or
know
grand...
that.
He's related to Mel Brooks.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Holy cow, okay.
Oh, well, there you go. Anyway, writing for the other is not easy at the best of times, and there's a lot of controversy around that. But I just don't think he pulls it off. And the other thing that gets me is, again, China's to blame. That's the second book I've written in the last 12 months where China's to blame for something.
Oh, and Russia's really bad, too.
Yeah, that's shitty as well. You know?
I found it quite ironic considering that...
There didn't have to be anyone to blame for the zombie.
The current climate in America,
Oh, but they weren't to blame. It just started there.
First off, it starts there. And second off, they basically cover it up.
It was the way it was covered up by China. And the fact that it started there,
they never explain what the zombie virus is.
There's something in the valley where the dam was built.
A kid gets bitten in a lake, and that's all you know.
In the dam where they flooded the valley.
Yeah.
And old De Chang meant that there's something there.
Yeah.
They dug too deep.
You really need to know.
I do have to say one thing though. One of the bits I love the most.
There are some really good bits.
Was the bit about North Korea and how they all might be all these zombies hitting in these underground mountains surrounding North Korea, and the South Korean guy who wants to go in and see what's going on. He's not allowed because they're scared he might, you know, crack open a mountain and 20 million zombies come pouring out. I loved that.
I kind of like the alternative that all the North Koreans are just in there.
Yeah.
They survived. They survived because they went and locked themselves away at the first hint of danger. It's like, fuck this, we're gone.
I'll tell you the chapter I really liked was the one from the point of view of the celebrity bodyguard. From inside of that compound.
Yeah.
And you can tell, he doesn't name names, but you can tell that this place is basically full of... personalities that are readily identifiable but never named by name.
Yeah.
And he just kind of takes a crowbar to them in a really funny kind of insightful way.
At least it seemed that way
in 2006 when, frankly, I'd had it up to here with Paris Hilton and the rest of them.
But I really like the submarine section, actually. I thought that was really cool.
It's quite tense, isn't it?
Yeah. I think there are some really good short stories in this book.
Yeah,
that's
And
right.
I think as a book, it actually kind of fails. I think, like, it's a neat idea, but... I just don't think he was able to carry it for the length of that book. And I think it becomes deadening.
But he did such a good job of exploring, like, all of the possible... The submarine one's a perfectly good example of, you know, can they survive underwater? What happens... Okay, so what happens to... you know what I mean? Like, just the exploring all of the angles, like, coming at it from every perspective. Just... I don't know. I think that's
why it's so interesting the first time you read it.
Yeah.
But then when you reread it and you already know all that... Then all of the other bits suddenly wave their hands and say, like, what about me? It's like, oh, yeah, I didn't notice you there in the corner, actually. Yeah. You're quite the white elephant. So,
so it's a book with gender issue, real gender problems.
Real gender issues.
I think it has, in fact, I'd go so far as to say
that the only, with the exception of one, who's Jessica, who's the body retrieval girl up in Canada.
Yeah.
I think it's up in the north anyway.
About how everyone froze to death.
With the exception of her, every other... female character has to be female for some part of her narrative to work. She actually has to be a woman.
Yeah.
In which case, there are basically no women in the book as people. Yeah. There are women there who have to be there because they're women. Yeah. So that character has to be female. But there was any number of other characters there where gender would have been irrelevant. I mean, I know, I guess in some of like the US military high echelons, they kind of got to be guys at the point the book is set. But there's so many characters that gender wouldn't have mattered. And some of those could have been women and they weren't. And it's almost like the only characters that were women because they kind of had to have a womb or tits or something.
And that is a major problem with the book.
It's a huge problem.
Well, you've kind of ruined Christmas for me.
Sorry. This is what we do.
It's a bad move.
You bring us your books and we go, no, cha, cha, cha.
Look, it is a fun read, though. It is if for the first time, because you guys were both reading it, I was reading it fresh.
The first time, it's a fun read.
It was a galloping amount of fun.
He's on a sentence by sentence level. He's actually a really good writer. I mean, you're right. I think the voices all merge into one blob, because as I said, they all sound the same.
Yeah.
But I think in terms of suspense and telling a story.
There are some
and
really
the
good
The world
stories.
Bit, which we haven't really said much, which you've spoken about, Cam, but we haven't said much about, is great. I mean, he has... How realistic is it? I don't know, but he's thought it through. He's genuinely thought it through, and I couldn't think of anything that that seemed like a plot hole or didn't seem to make... It all seemed to make sense, is what I'm saying.
The world building was good.
I'm surprised
like
it didn't get any Hugo / awards love at the time.
Yeah, that is kind of surprising.
Because it's a genuine science fiction novel.
I think it's a zombie book, though.
Yeah, that's...
I think at the time, in the mid-2000s...
What year was it published?
I don't think zombies were on the rise, to speak.
You usually have on your notes.
2006.
Yeah, 2006, you do,
I remember thinking even in 06, zombies were starting to feel a bit played out, I still fell into it.
Well, they're not played out because Feed is a Hugo-nominated book, so they're definitely not played out. In fact, if anything, this sparked off the next, if I'm not mistaken, World War Z sparked off the next bunch of zombie books.
Possibly.
Because it was a popular book. I mean,
it also followed up from his Zombie Survival Guide.
Yeah, it sounds like that was
which was what he wrote.
This.
He wrote first.
Yeah,
and that was more of a comedy.
And he takes the piss out of the book.
I haven't really read it,
but in this, he takes the piss out of it.
Yeah,
because he says, some characters say it was useless.
Yeah, because it was written as sort of like a half tongue in cheek, half what if zombies actually were real kind of book. I haven't actually read it.
Max, if you're listening to this, and the chances are Buckley's and none.
Max,
we want you to provide us because we are the audience, feedback as to why you stuffed up with the gender issues and why all the people from other countries sound the same, and did it really have to be China's fault? Other than that, great read, mate. And Cameron loves it.
Why did Russia turn into the theocracy, considering the way America is at the moment?
That said, I did sort of like the idea that Russian becomes expansionist again.
Oh, yeah.
That was quite cool. Yeah. And basically sort of, post-zombies... Back to the Cold War sort of situation, sort of. But, that was nice. Okay, we're moving on.
I
Jonathan, it's time for your book. We know Jonathan Strahan. And when I say we know him, we don't know him in a biblical sense.
Ian.
I haven't laid... What?
Oh, my God. I can't take you
anywhere. Well, I know. Cameron, have you ever met Jonathan?
I don't think I have, no.
He lives in Perth, so...
Oh, well, that would explain it.
Unless you've gone to conventions. So where's your copy of Eclipse? Because I don't remember every story off the top of...
I think it's
Can I borrow yours?
Yeah, go for it.
So Eclipse 4, I recommended it. There are a number of reasons why. A, because I hadn't read any other Eclipse books. Have you read Eclipse 1, 2 and 3? That's a no.
I have them at home.
I actually own.
I have a terrible habit of buying short story collections and looking at them and going, "That's awesome! I can't wait to read that." And they just...
I'm sure it makes you look very well read,
but apparently, not supporting.
I'm doing a lot better now, though. But as you said, I bought the book.
Yeah, no, you did. I bought the ebook. Actually, I did. I did get
did
a.
You get that cover.
It's got
on
an awesome cover. I love that cover.
Yes, that on the night. I think it's on the.
There are so many reasons why that cover is great.
I want it framed. I'd have that on my wall.
I think it's awesome.
Can I finish?
Sorry,
your sentence?
Please.
On the Baines Webscriptions ebook site, this is on there, so you can actually get it reasonably cheap if you want to buy an ebook version, which is what I did. I did get a sort of pre-book version from Jonathan. Which is very... As part of Last Short Story, which was... An arc, yeah. As part of Last Short Story. But I wanted to actually buy it. And so I did that. And no one really needed to know about that. But the cover is awesome. You are both right. First off, it's pink. That's pink, isn't it?
It's pink.
I'm colorblind. It's pink. It's more like... Something.
Oh, it's pink.
Yeah?
I'm colorblind.
That is pink.
It's kind of
pink.
Not that I'm really colorblind with pink, though. That is pretty pink. It's got an astronaut on it.
It has a female astronaut. It has a space woman.
How can you tell?
It's a space.
I was trying to work that out.
Why? Because I don't see a penis. No, I can't see boobies, and I can't see... Why?
It's the shape of her body. Look at her hips. Look at her... It's a woman.
Who is a space woman?
Straight
up
and
down. Genderizing now. That just could be it.
It's straight up. It is. It's straight up and down. I think it strikes me as being particularly feminine, mainly because of the pose. But if you look at the body, it's straight up and down.
No.
I'm sure this is fascinating to the people at home who can't.
No. I want to survey.
I want to survey this. She's a space woman.
Jonathan can't answer. I want to understand how many people think that is a space woman.
It's a feminine pose, I'll tell you that.
All right, look, there's a space woman on the cover, apparently. And there's doves, surrounded by doves behind a pink background.
It's a really great cover.
I think they're pigeons.
You know, when I first saw it, not that I told Jonathan this, I thought, but it just grows on you. Well, but I think, obviously, you guys loved it straight away.
I loved it.
And it works for the book.
It's not the cover you generally see on a science fiction anthology.
No, it's
superb. It's speculative fiction anyway. Eclipse is not just science fiction.
Jeremy Geddes did the cover. Good on you, Jeremy. And well done, Nightshade, for being bold and doing such a bold sort of cover. Now, I recommended this also because it's got a great lineup of writers. It does. And also because I needed to read something by Jonathan for last short story. I thought I killed two birds with one stone. You don't know what a last short story is, Cameron, but basically it's a bunch of people, Alyssa Krasenstein and Tansy, Raina Roberts and Alex
Pierce.
Yes, I was going to say that. And Sarah Parker and Jonathan. Well, Jonathan, yeah, he sort of coordinates it. And myself, who try to read as many short stories as we can throughout the year.
We try to read all. Okay.
We don't try to. No, it's not all. It is not all. It's as many as we can. I've failed. I did pretty well in the first few months, but I've sort of failed. It's because of the writer and the critic. But anyway, we won't go there.
Oh, yeah, the two books a month are killing you, especially since you've read most of them years ago.
Kirsten, you just don't know me, all right? I'm slow. I really am a slow reader. So I picked this because I wanted to kill two birds with one stone. Mm-hmm. And I can't say I was disappointed. This is, for me, there's, 17 stories or thereabouts? Again, Jonathan saying,
I didn't do a spreadsheet for this one. It didn't make me angry.
Yeah, Jonathan, well done. You didn't make Kirsten angry. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. There's 14 stories. Okay. 14 stories. More than half by women, Kirsten.
More than half. Oh,
yes. Cool. So it's dominated by women. I do that on purpose. Can I tell you why I've raised
that? You better hope we don't go to Tasmania because that's where Tansy lives.
Yeah, she'll kick me in the ghoulies. Can I tell you why I mentioned that, though? My last live journal post before I decided not to do live journal posts anymore.
Oh, your flounce.
I did not flounce. It wasn't because of the last live journal post. It's because I've run out of time to do things, and live journal is the first thing to go. But I did write about, there was a, and Cam, I don't know what you're aware of, but there's a short story collection, Solaris, Rising of the New Sun, I think it's called, edited by Ian Waits, who's edited a number of short story collections.
It's another gender fail debate.
Yeah, another gender fail in that it's thing. Got 18 or so writers, of which 4 are female.
Right.
And while there's been a lot of people who've defended him, and you know, a lot of people say it's not gender, it's not an issue of gender bias and blah blah blah. For me, it basically is because with Eclipse for Jonathan shows quite easily how it doesn't take much work. I mean, I know Jonathan had issues with the first Eclipse.
All I'm trying to say is it can be done.
You can do it without losing quality and without people saying, oh, it's all tokenism. And you know what I'm saying, Kirsten?
You can have girls without losing quality? Yeah, is that what you're saying?
I am saying that. I can't do a valley voice. Can you do the podcast in that voice?
No.
Okay.
I think the problem about – you can't. It's really hard to take any one anthology.
Yeah.
Yeah. The problems around the most recent, you know, blah, 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 not enough women, blah, 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 was not so much the anthology itself or you know, most of the things that get picked up. It's the lines that are used to sort of defend it.
Yeah.
And it's just so, you just get out the bingo card.
Yeah, you're right.
You know.
I mean, look, this is not an attack on Ian Waits. He did an anthology. It's mostly men. There's a few women. The women he's chosen, I think Tricia Sullivan, a couple of others. Fine, whatever. All I ask is that editors, when this is brought to their attention, if they haven't already realised, that they acknowledge that it could have been better. That's all.
And
that's
maybe all. Go, oh.
You know, and or they provide, you know, they rather than just go, oh, I went to a bunch of women and they said no and sort of put the blame on other people.
And they don't trot out the same old line about, just like what I like and I don't even notice gender.
You can be proud of a collection and it can I brought up Midnight Echo. That did have more men than women and we're proud of it, but, you know, could we have done better? Possibly.
Well, on the other hand, I responded to someone who did reply to your live journal, talking about how we published a significantly greater percentage of women in Midnight Echo than we received submissions from. I think we had about 10% of subs for Midnight Echo from women, and we had about 25% publication rate. And he was saying, "Oh, well, it's obviously gender bias towards women then, because you published so many more than you received." But, you know, kind of got to point out that about 25% of the subs we received from men were good and 75% were kind of crap.
Yeah.
Whereas the ratio was inverted with the women. So 75% of the subs we received from women were actually good.
Yeah. And
so it was, you know, there were just.
But could we have done better? as editors of that magazine had a better ratio in Australia of female horror writers? Because I can think about five or six people we probably should have asked, we probably didn't.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head. And I'm willing to accept that. Yeah. But I learned from it. Not that I'll ever edit anything again. But if I ever were, I'd learn. Sorry, Cameron, we're keeping you out of this, but I'd learn from it. But,
anyway.
But this book, Eclipse 4, edited by Jonathan Strahan, is fantastic. One dud story for me.
And has a space woman on the front.
One dud story for me.
What was the dud?
The dud for me was the Damien Broderick story.
Yeah, I've never really been able to come at Damien Broderick.
I just didn't get it.
The cat, the talking cat one.
Yeah. Come on, Cam, did you read it?
I did. Yeah, I read. This is a crazy thing for me. It was a bit twee, but I really liked the world. And the thing is, what I didn't like about the story was just the way that it ended. It just seemed like it was sawn off and capped on, if you know what I mean.
It had lost me. I mean, I actually stopped understanding the story. I stopped getting what the point of the story was after a while.
If you
can explain it to me, that'd be lovely.
For me, it was such a beautifully painted world, and like I think painted is the right word for it. That I was really happy just to be there and just kind of just drift along with it. So when it went out of the bean counter's world, when it went out of the streets of the city, when it went out of her interactions, with that talking cat, when it went, and also his word choices were just delicious. So I found it was just really pleasurable being there. It actually kind of felt like slipping into a hot bath after a really long day.
Really?
Yeah.
I couldn't have had a more
That changed, or more to the point, that started wearing off fairly quickly once they went inside the mountain, and then it kind of sped towards an ending, which I thought was a bit of a shame.
But you actually enjoyed the writing.
I did. Yeah.
I couldn't.
Yeah,
couldn't
I
don't.
The style just grated. That was kind of my.
See, based on this conversation,
there are others which are a bit.
Yeah, like, I'm learning something here today. I think I'm learning that my approach to. I think I'm kind of like, I'm 50-50 enjoying the story the way that most people do, and 50% kind of looking at kind of cannibalizing it for myself. Do you know what I mean?
Like, so you liked it because there was stuff you could steal.
No. So it was kind of like, oh, that's a really interesting way. I wouldn't have thought of that. And then I kind of get inside the mechanics of it, and so I kind of, I don't know, without making it all about me, but the thing is, I think I was kind of enjoying it on a few levels. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, whatever those levels were, I wasn't on the same, and I just did not.
All right. To be fair, Damien Broderick, he had a book that came out when I was in high school with the really unfortunate title of Striped Holes. Which a friend of mine really recommended to me, and I thought it was okay. It was kind of like Douglas Adams light at the time. Everybody was going off on Hitchhikers, and that was the first and only thing I've ever read of Damien up until this, and I was actually surprised by it.
Wow, Striped Holes, and then you read about the Bean Counter's cat.
Oh, yeah.
But that for me was the weaker story by a long shot. I mean, there are stories, as you said, you're about to say, there are some stories that, good but not brilliant. But it's the standard is of a high quality.
Oh, yeah. If I was going to pick my favourite.
Okay. What if they're the same as mine? Then we're going to just repeat each other.
Same as well, I'd say I picked out five that would have been the ones I thought were just out of the park. Well, two definitely out of the park, and that was Tidal Forces by Caitlin Kiernan and Story Kit by Kidge Johnson. I haven't read enough Kidge Johnson. I need to read more because everything that I've read of hers has kind of broken me in a really good way.
I did Story Kit.
So those two I just loved. They were amazing, and they were right near the front of the book. Which was almost a shame for me because my trajectory of the book sort of started really high and then took a slow dip.
Yeah.
But the other three I really quite liked were Nalo Hopkinson's Old Habits, the Jeffrey Ford double story, and Peter Ball's with the dragon, the Western dragon story. That was fantastic. And actually, in my opinion, it kind of could have stopped there because the last two were a little... They fell a bit flat for me.
Yeah. For me, I thought the standout story was the Nala Hopkinson. I thought that was awesome. Just loved that story. I love the Swirsky, the afterlife story.
Yeah.
I like that. Story Kit. I missed the point of it. I have to reread.
But then I'm a sucker for metafiction.
Yeah, it's metafiction.
So it's...
I've done a philosophy degree, so I just assumed that that sort of shit would just go with me,
Well, would you just read, go with you?
Go, just I get it. You know,
oh, okay.
But I'm finding that I'm actually quite thick in some ways, and
in some ways,
Story Kit just went right over my head. I get the idea, but I just didn't.
No, I really dug Danilo Hopkinson.
Yeah,
that was kind of like,
how awesome is that story?
It, what Story Kit?
No. Danilo Hopkinson.
Old Habits. In the mall.
Isn't that one of the?
Oh yeah, no, sorry.
You didn't like that one.
No. Story Kit. I'm totally sold on.
With Kit Johnson. Yeah.
Danilo Hopkinson. It's a good little story.
Yeah. I like the ending of it with the pressing hands.
I'm sorry, but that to me, I've never read any Danilo Hopkinson, which is now a crime that I've committed because I'm going to have to look for some of the stuff because I thought that was that to me is a should be a nominee for something. Well, fantasy Bram Stoker.
Really,
it was a
Bram. Look, I guess Bram,
really,
yeah.
yes, and I'll tell you why because it's very rare that I read. First off, afterlife stories, and there's two in this book, and they're both good. And they're both good though.
I was disappointed by this one, Wick.
You're right. Well, that's sort of a.
You're talking about the Swirsky.
Yeah, the Swirsky. There's two genuine
I put
stories.
Sort of Old Habits more with. Yeah, anyway, yeah, that's right. You know,
afterlife
right.
stories can be a bit on the nose, but the chill. I was chilled, and I read that on the tram, so it just got me. This idea that the dead. Are in limbo. Fine, that's been done before.
But they replay their death every day.
Yes, they replay their death every day. Idea one that just got me. Idea two was that if one of the dead is starting to feel, getting sensations, taste, if they admit it, all the other dead just fucking, you know, heap on them and rip them to shreds just so they can feel the same
thing. Someone's got the candy.
To me, that was amazing. But the third bit was this concept that although they're dead and they've died, there's actually an unknown. A door that leads nowhere, potentially leads to wherever, and that some actually commit suicide by running through. That is just a mind-bending idea. That really got me. That was really well executed in my naughty bits. That got me.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was a lovely.
I love the ending. I thought that the ending was pretty much pitch perfect for that story.
Yeah.
It was just fantastic.
It's my favorite. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I did think it was kind of one note though.
I think my favorite probably is the Keenan, which is probably no great
that
surprise.
That is my second favorite. That is my second favorite. That is an.
But I know the
story.
Kit Johnson story is just.
No.
I read it again today, and it's just awesome.
Yeah, the Kit Johnson
it's
story.
Fantastic.
The thing is, it really resonated for me because it was like,
To be fair, I think maybe it's clearly a writer's story.
Yeah, like if you put it.
I'm saying that from the point of view.
Put it this way. If you've ever been in a car crash, right?
Yeah, no, I haven't.
And then somebody wrote an impressionistic short story about the experience
crash.
Of a car crash,
which is kind of what Story Kit is.
Then you would probably really relate to it because it would be like, holy fuck, you've been there too.
Or, you know, you're going to get a lot more out of like a Doctor Who universe story. Than someone who doesn't watch Doctor Who.
I'm glad you've reduced it to a Doctor Who. Because obviously the car crash example...
You're the one who reduced it.
The car crash example wasn't working. I'm personalising it for you. Thank you. Yeah. No, look, okay, fine. I did once consider myself to be a bit of a writer. I've written a number of Doctor Who short stories. Mm. Highly acclaimed. Didn't win any awards.
But I think because it's about writing a story, and it's got about... at least three, if not four, different layers of character and story and meaning to it. And because it is about, you know, on a very simplistic level, the mechanics of writing.
Yeah. But it's also about heartbreak.
Yeah.
It's about someone getting over heartbreak by
funneling it through.
I missed
work,
all, I missed all
so
that,
close.
But I admit I have to reread it. Unlike the Broderick, which I wouldn't reread.
And I love that it, but the other thing I really loved about it is that it presents itself as transparent, you know, like here's what the story is. Here's the Wikipedia reference. But it's actually quite opaque. You've got to read it a couple of times and tease out.
Yeah, and I think that's what I need to do.
It was really short of actually making a film about being inside a person's head who's just gone through a horrific breakup and is trying to fictionalize it in order to survive it.
Yeah.
From using the mental toolkit of someone who has
and
been writing for a long time.
The last
line. God, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Oh,
that
should I
that
leave? Should I
get, it just kills no, you. Just, you just read it.
I may need a moment. No, really. It was honestly.
I think it might be my favorite story.
You mean in an orgasmic way or in a.
No, it's.
I wanted to hug.
It's amazing.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
the last line of that story.
I'm sorry.
It's perfect.
I honestly really feel terrible because you guys are seriously. No one can see this, but I can.
But you're not a huge Kitty Johnson fan.
No, I liked. I didn't like Ponies. Like, that's the one that she's.
Yeah, do you like Spa?
I love Spa.
Oh, okay. I thought you didn't like Spa
No,
either.
Well, I don't know who you're referring
to. I'm sorry.
But the two of you are so... It's partly the alcohol, but you're so flushed.
I had stopped. I had so one glass.
You're a one-pot screamer, Kirsten, so...
I think very much it is a story that someone who isn't a writer or a creative person... Yeah. Or doesn't work with that side of things, it possibly won't resonate as much. I'm not saying no, you have to be a writer to get it. I'm just saying that the resonance might not be as deep.
I'll read it again.
Can I?
Keep going.
Can I draw a really quick analogy?
No.
I never understood white cube art. Yet, I had someone explain white cube art to me, and once you've got the language for it, suddenly it's like, holy shit. 40 minutes later, I'd forgotten that language.
And now it's met again.
But yeah, now it's like, you got paid for that? No, but if you had the experiential language of being on the other side of that page, then I think you would read that and you would have the same reaction that...
Yeah.
So do you think it's a... Okay, it's probably going to go over the heads of some people.
I freaking love it.
But do you think it should be on award ballots?
Oh, God, yeah.
Okay.
I think this is a story which is about story.
Okay. Well,
art.
Can I ask you another question?
Yep.
Do you congratulate Jonathan for putting such an experimental and bold story? Because actually, there's quite a few of those. It's I know Eclipse's mandate is a bit like that, but we've got to give the editor some slap on the back.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, this is a story
that's
which
probably
you,
a bit too much wine for me.
Which you wouldn't.
I'll take care of it later.
Wouldn't find in I guess a more conventional. Science fiction / spec fic. I mean, it is. It's very...
I mean, the point I'm making is that...
The form is very...
It's not a really a themed collection, and it's great to see these...
No, it's not a themed collection.
Well, because if it was a vampires collection or a zombies collection, it wouldn't exist, and that's one of the pluses. That sort of story wouldn't
exist. I don't think you can say that. I think there's room for experimental work in any genre. I think it depends on the type of anthology. It depends on the editor who's putting it together. I guess it depends on the brief that the editor's working with. I think, yeah, I like I said, I haven't read enough of her work, but I've now got to go out and buy just about everything she has in print, just based on just three or four stories that I've read of hers, which in every one has been amazing. So, and I think Story Kit is good, and I really don't buy into the idea that. Like any work, like artwork, visual arts, dramatic arts, written arts, whatever the art is, I don't buy into the fact, the idea that if it's somehow not accessible to everyone, it's less worthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't buy into that. I think you have people can like different things.
But that's
things,
my point,
and that's okay.
That Jonathan's put this in here, even though it may not work for everyone.
But I think there's a lot of stories. I mean, obviously there's at least one story which doesn't, I mean... The stories work for different people, and I think it's a really strong collection because it does bring together a whole lot of disparate voices. And
you were talking about the Caitlin.
Yeah, it's one of like it's such a good story.
It's about a woman who has a black hole inside her.
Right at the top of her game. It's fantastic.
And describing it like that, a woman who has a black hole inside her is
well, a woman
the
who has
a singularity
she's
or something
coinciding with the emergence of a black hole.
Kind of. Okay. Did you get the Lovecraft references? You must have.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when that happened, it was like, oh, I don't know. I just kind of wanted.
I did not pick the ending. I mean, I've read a lot of. I've read most of what Keenan has in print, and there are familiar rhythms that her work has, which is not a criticism, because they're enjoyable.
Yeah.
That's her work. Yeah. And I had felt this story going in a complete different direction.
So did I.
And it ended, and it was just...
It was happy.
I know!
I really wasn't expecting that. And the thing,
I know!
I know, and the thing is, I actually...
I'm reading, I just went, oh. Oh.
Yeah, I actually kind of wanted to lightly applaud her for that. It was really.
It's a beautiful, like, it's a beautiful story in every sense of the word. The writing is beautiful. Mm. The story is, the character, the relationship between the two women, it's just...
Isn't she just a cracking writer, Caitlin Keenan?
Caitlin Keenan is, in my opinion, actually not just my opinion, the opinion of a lot of people, probably one of the, if not the best, certainly stylists working in the darker side of spec fic, and absolutely the most underrated. It's absolutely criminal.
That's not going to last, though, is it?
Well, no, but
it has
a lot
lasted
of books.
A long time.
She's been writing since what, 93, 92?
She has got dozens. It's absolutely criminal. I mean, she should be, you know, yeah, it's just fucking pathetic, actually. Everybody out there who's listening to the podcast, if you have not read Caitlin Keenan, you need to go and buy
it. We spoke about
right
Red
now.
Tree in a previous podcast. Red Tree is a really good
Red
starting
Tree
point.
Is it is phenomenal.
It is a fantastic book. And this actually is similar style. Some of the themes are similar as well to Red Tree. Yeah, there are.
Oh, I guess in the
relationship.
A relationship disintegrating.
Correct, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I did wonder whether the black hole, whatever, coinciding was a bit obvious in terms of the metaphor of it, in relating to the relationship side. But
this is what spec fic does.
Yeah, well, you mean a la Star Trek where...
This is what non-realist fiction does. Non-realist fiction takes stuff which doesn't happen, can't happen, wouldn't happen, couldn't happen, and uses that safe thing, which is what Kid Johnson talks about in Story Kit. Uses the safety of something which can't happen, couldn't happen, wouldn't happen, will never happen, to talk about what does happen.
Yeah, okay. We could, you know, how long are we going for? 70 minutes? 80 minutes?
Actually, yeah, quite a bit.
Shit.
We should probably move on.
The thing is, this is where Jonathan McElmont is right, that we do too many books now.
We do.
Because we could speak about Eclipse 4 for another hour. And, well, I could anyway. You two could just leave the room, I suppose. But I just want to quickly say, me personally... I thought the Andy Duncan, which starts the collection, cause I thought we may as well mention all the writers, quickly.
Yep.
Andy Duncan, that starts the collection, Slow as a Bullet, really nice Shaggy Tail story.
Nice
fun.
Voice, really nice voice.
That, yeah.
And a good start to the collection.
Really good voice.
And we've spoken about the Keenan, Broderick, we've spoken about Kitch Johnson, we've spoken about Man in Grey by Michael Swanwick. It's a nice concept. It's sort of like
a... little letdown. It felt a bit pedestrian for Swanwick.
Yeah?
Okay.
I thought it was a bit like a Twilight Zone
story. Like, it was good.
Story.
It was readable. Yeah, it was very Twilight. It felt like with Michael Swanwick, you kind of expect a...
You think you found
another
him?
Level?
I could see it just going for liftoff and just keep bouncing off the tarmac.
Yeah, you could say. I thought it was all right. I mean, maybe he phoned it in, but I wouldn't.
Oh, that's nasty.
No. That is nasty. But I actually enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. I'm not saying
the Hopkinson. I thought was the standout for me.
Really good.
Gwyneth Jones and Vicar of Mars is part of a shared universe.
Okay,
it was all right.
It kind of skimmed off me, but I got the feeling there was more to it
that
I wasn't getting.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut
you off. Your dad? The Gwyneth Jones, Vicar of Mars.
I enjoyed it. It was well done, but it didn't stick with me.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I think it's because if there's one complaint I have about the collection, that there are two stories in here that are part of a shared-ish connected universe. And,
one of them's the last story.
Yeah, and it's
Jonathan.
The longest. Yeah, I don't know if that's such a smart idea. But anyway, Jonathan can yell at us if he wants. Fields of God by Rachel Swirsky, which is my second favourite? I think it was. It's up there with the Keenan for me. That's the second Afterlight story. It's because it's funny.
It is funny.
It's very, very funny.
Yeah.
And I did know Swirsky did funny because I've read a couple of her stories and they're not that
it's
funny.
It's also sad.
Yeah, it is sad, but it's funny and sad. It's really funny.
Yeah.
And good on her. Well done, Rachel. That's so patronising. But I really, really, really... And I actually would like to see that one get mentioned in awards, but it probably won't. It's got a, you know...
It's cool.
It's got a great first line. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The Eileen Gunn, which is Thought Experiment, and I don't actually even remember
that
one.
Thought Experiment.
Yeah, wow, that really stuck with us.
Oh, no. That's the one.
Ralph Drum Jr. as well. That's a beauty.
Yeah, I like that.
It's not it's a bad title. It's a very bland title, which is why we couldn't peg the story.
That's
to
a great story.
Yeah, that was
good.
Yeah.
It had a time travel one.
And
yeah.
It had a pretty good final paragraph.
It's actually the sort of story you'd find, and this is going to sound really terrible, but it's the sort of story you'd find in Analog, but would be infinitely better than anything else around it. No, it is, because it's that sort of cute little time travel story.
You need
story.
To start reading for last short story.
Yeah, I know. But it's this cute little short time travel story. And it is just, kicks ass.
It's funny, too.
Yes, another
really funny.
So that's the Eileen Gunn. And then we've got, because I've just gone from the contents pages, which was really smart of me. Yeah, here we go. We've got the Jeffrey Ford, which I like too. The double of my double is not my double. I'm not convinced by the end, though. It felt like a jokey end.
It is a jokey end, but I think that's kind of the point.
But unlike the Andy Duncan, which is a jokey end as well, that's pitched as a shaggy dog tail. I don't know if the Jeffrey Ford is pitched as a shaggy dog tail.
It's not a shaggy dog tail, but it's got that, like, it's got black humour running all through it.
It's an idea that seems to sort of, I don't want to say inverts, but it kind of turns on itself and then it turns on itself again. Do you know what I mean?
It's great until the end for me. It peters out for me with a joke. Yeah. And it sort of felt like those episodes of Star Trek at the end where they all laugh.
Oh, God.
You know, except without the actual, But it's still a good story. It's not a bad story. It's a great story. Nine Oracles by Emma Bull.
I couldn't get it. I liked the idea of that story, but I just it kind of skated over me.
Did it have a cohesive thread?
No.
Or was it just nine pieces of flash fiction?
Yeah.
In a sense, yeah.
Well, they were kind of related.
Nine women. Nine women who were predicting the future.
But they were related. They were thematically related from women who were trying to tell people what was going to go wrong and no one would listen.
Yeah. And I got.
Yeah. I think it could have been a bit better realised.
Okay.
But
We spoke about the Peter Ball dying young, which I
really
liked too.
Dragons in the Wild West.
That was great. That was well done, Peter.
Who is an Australian
and is a top-notch writer. And the last two stories, we've got the Joe Walton, the Panda Coin, which is a story about a coin, because you didn't read that one, did you, Cam?
I actually didn't make it to the last three.
Because of time.
Well, read the Peter Ball.
In fact, I'm going to probably finish reading it tonight.
Yeah, so you should. So we won't spoil the last couple for your sake. But
we're spoiling it for everybody else.
No, we spoil things on this podcast.
Yeah. Go crazy.
The Panda Coin is basically about, it's the old thing, you know, that movie about the dollar bill that goes from one person to another?
Yeah. Oh,
it's the story of the dollar bill. It's the coin.
And the coin illustrates parts of the world that it's in.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, not like a bad penny story, but
just a spying penny.
Okay. Oh, right. Okay, cool. Right, yeah.
Good point. That's a bit of a spoiler.
A penny that looks at things.
So. It's
like you get a little window into different facets of the world that it's on. It's a science fiction.
I didn't find the world interesting.
It was just a bit too cute for me.
Twee-ish.
Not as twee as the Broderick, but... Yeah, it was like, that's a nice conceit.
It felt like an idea.
But the story?
The film came out yonks ago. It felt like an idea from that period. It just didn't feel... The world that she's describing
nice
is actually
conceit.
Quite interesting.
I just didn't do it for me. I didn't feel a story was really woven well around that conceit.
Kirsten says it better than I do. And finally, the longest thing, which is close to a novella, if not it is a novella... James Patrick Kelly's Tourists.
The problem with Tourists is that it's another world. It's a world he set other stories in.
I think it's potentially the third story.
Right. And I haven't read any of the others in the series,
which is, and in fact, plus minus, Jonathan will correct, has been nominated for Best Novella for this Hugo's, which is the one before this.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The problem with it is that, A, it's the longest story in the collection.
It's really long.
And I actually thought it was very readable, interesting to read, but it feels like the jumping off point for the next story. So it feels like the middle book of the trilogy, because something major's happened in the story before.
And something major's about to happen by the end.
By the end, but then there's a lot of middle, and it feels like a middle.
This anthology just ended quite flatly for me.
Yeah.
As I said before, I would have, like, if it ended with Peter Ball's story, like, that's a nice end.
Yeah.
And the other two were just... And because the last one was a novella as well, it wasn't just, like, a shorter story I didn't quite get into. It was really long. It was funny.
I mean, you're making out like it's 500
pages.
Well, it's the longest work in the
Yeah,
it's double
the
length of anything else in the collection.
So, but to end on a marathon, as it were, it felt like an odd choice for an ending. If he'd flipped the other two, if he'd had the Panda Coin end the anthology... For me, that would have felt a better rhythm to the book.
I mean, I know we're not editors.
We're not editors.
We're not editors, and so...
Hi, Jonathan.
Yeah, hi, Jonathan. So we really shouldn't be telling John how to do his job.
He so broke our rule. We're not meant to recommend books by people we know.
Whatever.
I've just realised you sneakily applied the editor clause to our
rule. I'm recommending Rob Shearman's book later in the year.
Keep going.
But yeah, I do wonder whether... And obviously, Jonathan would have thought of this, whether it would have fit in the centre.
Well, see,
but it might have weighed down the center of the anthology.
I think it's I think it's a good place near the end. I just don't know that it should have been the end.
Okay.
An editor friend of mine was telling me just the other day that apparently most people don't read short story collections chronologically.
I know,
I can't believe
that.
That's tragic.
That hurts.
Because a good editor, as far as I'm aware, not being a good editor, really works hard.
God, I mean,
we worked hard on Midnight Echo to make sure it flowed in a certain way.
Yeah.
Not because the stories are connected, because we want
mind
to see
progression. Admittedly, I have in the past cherry-picked collections. Not collections so much, but anthologies for like, I'll read the...
Yeah,
Poppy
that's
Bright
you,
story,
yeah,
I'll
exactly.
read the
That's because either
Neil
A,
Gaiman
most
story.
Of the other writers you've never heard of or they're duds, or B, there's your favourite writer.
But
I don't do that
first. Very often.
The thing about the clips is that Jonathan's always getting the best, or some of the best writers out there, and so you do want to read it in an order. And I know he would have thought
plus,
about how it's arranged.
Kiernan's
would
and
have
Johnson's
really
stories were at the front, so I didn't have long to wait.
Yeah, well. Anyway, we should move on because we've only been talking about this for 3 hours now.
So we're going to talk about the book.
Jonathan, Eclipse 4 is great.
Oh,
everyone,
thumbs up.
Go
yeah,
buy
totally.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
really
wonderful.
Good.
There's
it's
some
awesome.
Award-winning stories. Should be in the future award-winning stories in there.
I would be very surprised if two or three of those stories don't turn up on ballots somewhere.
So well done, Jonathan. You can still be our friend. So the next story
maybe
is
maybe we
chose,
can
so.
Still be his friend, is what you should be saying. Okay, so...
You know what we should just say? And we read The Hunger Games. And that's the end of this podcast.
I did not read three books to just do that. No. I recommended Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins, which,
you did.
I'm a little behind because I did only read it a few months ago and it was published in 2008. But it was one of those ones that I kind of resisted because, it's The Hunger Games and it was a thing and it was, there's resistance there. That's my own personal issue. But I read it and it's awesome. I loved it. And I read the first one about 3 months ago, and I read the last two this past week in about 3 days.
Wow.
I was sick for like a whole day, so I just stayed in bed and read a book.
So I broke
fantastic.
A rule. I broke a rule. I actually
you
hadn't
didn't
finished the book.
Finish the book.
And this is so cute. Can I tell you a cute story, Cameron?
Go for it.
We were driving to your place, and she had the Android phone in one hand, my iPad in her other hand. And she was checking how to get to your place because you live out in the nice part of Melbourne. And, and on the other hand, she was reading to me the last few pages that I hadn't read of The Hunger Game. How beautiful is that?
That's how committed I am.
Seriously, like a bedtime story, I nearly fell asleep and vined the wheel.
That's
I nearly
how committed,
into
that's
a
how committed that one of us is to this podcast.
Okay. I ran out of time, but it's not like I only read 4% of the book and I don't know what happens. I read... 96%.
If I hadn't read the bit to you in the car, you would have missed a major thing.
Your point is, again, well made. Very well made. What did I think of the book?
What did you think of the book?
I loved it, except...
Uh-huh.
Again, it passed the tram test, so I didn't get me to sleep during in the mornings. In fact, I was reading it quite quickly, even though I didn't get to finish it. One, but the... Again, it comes down to maybe I'm not the right audience for some of these young adult books because although they're quite adulty with the violence and the blood and the gruelingness, I got times when I wanted to take Cantus and
Katniss.
The potato. I wanted to take the potato because she's named after a potato. Is that?
I thought it was a turnip.
Oh, whatever, a vegetable.
It's a tuba.
Turnip's funnier.
Turnip. Okay. Katniss, and I wanted to slap her. I really did. I know I say this a lot.
Yeah, no,
but
so did
I. She gets really annoying in the middle where she's first off doubting her. Okay, first off, she comes off in the first third as that girl or boy who you went to school with or uni who always said they failed their tests and ended up getting 100. I fucking can't stand that person.
That was me.
That's one way of looking at it. Yeah. One way of putting it. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you.
That's how she sounds like, I'll do so badly because I'm not trained or I've only hunted with a bow and arrow. A bloody, bloody, blur. Oh, I got 11 out of 12 from the Game Masters. A bloody, bloody, blur. I'm so shocked. Everyone's shocked.
That's because she did like a really bad thing.
No, I know that, but it's but you know how you get that young female protagonist in young adult fiction that's just seems to be rife, who's talks herself down, says she's not very good looking, yet obviously everybody wants to be her. Everybody else wants to be around her. And
no
she's got,
one wants to be Katniss.
Oh, okay.
No,
but she's got all these like skills coming out the wazoo, and it's you know what
she's
I mean.
She's got
like,
one skill.
Okay, there's a
she can fire a bow.
No.
Well, it's a very handy skill for the book.
Yeah, it is.
And No, she's got more than one skill. She actually supported her family while her mother was catatonic.
Well, that's why she's good with the bow, because she had to support her family.
Yeah, yeah, I get that. I get that. But it's the insecurity of the female character that...
Oh, my God. No, wait, hang on. Females are insecure? Like, about boys and, like, growing up and how people see them?
Insecurity I didn't get. Insecurity I didn't get. What I got was sullen.
Like, oh, yeah, maybe.
Actually, you know what? I'm going to let you finish because I've got a thesis here.
Cam, we've only got about 3 minutes before the time runs out. But and that's because you wouldn't answer the first question I asked about the 2008, why you didn't get a contract. Anyway, so, back to the book. Obviously, yes, I got that. I was thinking to myself, if I was a 16-year-old girl, wow, that'd be different. I'd probably relate to it a lot more, but I'm a 36-year-old white guy, bit of Jew in me, and... It just goes over my... I don't know why I mentioned that. It goes a bit over... It just grates with me because I want her to wake up. I want her to go, yes, Petra, whatever his name is, the boy.
Peter,
you whatever.
You really had a problem with the names in this book.
They're weird names, though. Hamish.
Wow, switch Harmage, a couple of Sinner. Letters around.
Yeah, it always gets me. Yes, he loves you. He's loved you from the very... Fucking figure it out already.
No, fuck it. You know what was really cool about this book? That not only was the unrequited love thing happening... not just on stage. The impetus came from the young men, but it was also an unrequited love story told from the point of view of the person who's doing the unrequiting.
Is that
really
unique?
Fucking rare.
Okay.
Yeah, but didn't
like it's usually about the person going, oh, I really love them. They don't know who I am, and by the end they do, and it's all wonderful. And this was the girl going, I really don't know how I feel about you guys, and I've kind of got more important things to do, like live. So stop it. It was fantastic. It was fantastic to have this young.
And this continues because I haven't read the other two books.
This young girl.
This continues on because I assume there's a.
Yeah, it was great to have this character who. Isn't thinking about boys all the time. Does occasionally, of course, but, that's not her impetus.
Aren't you tired of the love triangle thing? Hasn't that been done to death?
That's classic. I mean, done to death. I mean, come on. I mean, it's never going to be done to death.
But the thing is...
Because I haven't read the next two books, so I don't know how much of the love triangle is pushed.
No, but the thing is, it subverted the love triangle because you've got the love triangle happening and you've got the person at the crux of the triangle, instead of being torn between two people, she actually doesn't really care. She just has a job to do.
So how's this different from Twilight? Isn't that the same dude?
No, because Bella loves them both and can't decide which one to have.
I actually think Twilight soured me a little bit on... That said, I did like the book. Sorry, are you done?
Cam, please. Nothing can stop you. Go. I'll eat a gingerbread. I'm going to eat a gingerbread man while you're speaking.
I did like the book. I did like the book, but I can't see myself going back for a second helping. I can't see myself going for a sequel. Also,
Why?
While I was in the middle of reading this, like when you recommended this to me, I'd never actually heard of this series. Maybe I'd been hiding under a rock.
Oh,
yes.
Right.
Rock.
You must have been.
And then I was walking down the street and suddenly somebody was wearing a Hunger Games t-shirt. And I was
what
the hell?
It's pretty big.
It's a movie. And,
it's Twilight big. Yeah.
Wow. Twilight. Yeah. It's Twilight big. Okay. Well, anyway,
maybe slightly below Twilight. Okay, it's big. It's huge.
The movies will be very popular, and the first book translates beautifully.
I don't know how they're going to film this. How the fuck are they going to film children murdering each other, like shooting each other in the face with bows? Like, how are they going to do that?
I think the hardest one is getting around the room.
Honestly, it's like Enid Blyton reimagined Turkey Shoot. It's fucking crazy.
No, that's that should be a quote on our podcast.
A. Milne's the
running
man. There's
a 12-year-old Rue who is in
Rue's death is awful.
We haven't actually explained the concept, which is...
This is a spoilerific podcast, but if you've not read the book, then Wikipedia it, God's sake.
You are so...
Actually, yeah. Just stop. Pause right now. Hit Wikipedia. Come back. Yeah.
So Rue's a 12-year-old.
Yeah. Rue's death is particularly nasty. It's on screen. There's not a lot that are really... And it's funny because I had to read the next two books to decide how I really felt about The Hunger Games, because there were some problems I had with The Hunger Games that if they weren't resolved or teased out or inverted with the other two books,
can you tell me
would
without
have been
spoiling
problems.
Them?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one was that Katniss kind of gets a free pass on the killing.
Yes, I was going to mention that. That shat me.
But, and if The Hunger Games had been a standalone book, I would have thought that's a bit, to give her the free pass is a little, I mean, she does kill people, but
Well, she kills
it's
the boy.
Justified.
Kills,
it's in
yeah, the division one, you know. The district one guy who kills Rue.
Yeah,
you could say she's killed the guys with the tracker jackers, the wasps. But
and,
that's
and
a bit...
she kills Kato at the end, but only because he's like, yeah.
She's never backed into a corner and made to kill somebody that we care about
yeah,
or that she
yeah,
cares,
exactly
anything that will make
she,
her appear
she
to be a
hasn't actually
prayer.
Had to kill someone she was
yeah she's never
with.
Yeah she's never done anything to
but,
make her appear unsympathetic
but,
yes. But she becomes Rambo, I'm assuming.
But
the
other
two,
no, she doesn't. But the other two books, and it was like, if it had been a standalone book, I would have been disappointed in that and thought it would have been a cop out. But the fact that she was writing two more, she had to have somewhere to go, and she does go somewhere.
Yeah, so she, you're telling me she slaughters, like goes in the capital and just
it's worse than that.
All right, don't spoil it.
I'm not going to spoil it. I'm just going to say, I mean,
spoil this book.
The ending of the trilogy was just amazing. Like, really, really amazing.
Are you cheeky?
And really
you
mature.
While we're doing
no, actually,
podcast,
no, actually, I made notes on my phone while I was reading.
Oh, God, for sitting there, I thought you thought
tweeting.
This is a bit dull.
Yeah, I'm talking to my friends.
Yeah, so no, well, while you're checking your notes, I thought what I loved is that. Yes, it's about people stuck in a forest trying to survive, and that to me normally means dull, but she's really good at the pacing. She's really good at making the next thing happen. It's just the pacing is fantastic of the book. Well done, Suzanne Collins.
Which is not that easy with a first-person narrative.
No, because things you've got to make things happen around that person, and they can't feel contrived, and they never felt contrived.
Yep.
And, I was just as much as she gave me the shits, the character... halfway through, I was thinking, no, go, girl.
And it's good. I mean,
there's that voyeuristic element.
Irritated me as well, too, a lot of the time. But she's kind of.
But don't we become the voyeurs that everyone else becomes?
Of course, but that's part of it.
Yeah, I thought you might say that. Cam, where's your thesis?
Oh, no, I was just going to say that, I don't know, the whole sullen thing with the girl, like the. I should probably wrap this up really quickly.
No.
The whole sullen thing with the girl, with like you know two boys like me, and you know I'm the whole sort of passive aggressive. No, I'm really not that special thing that you were going on about. Really shat me to tears because it was there, not as prevalent in something like say Twilight, where you actually just want to throw Bella under a bus.
But Bella's not special.
No, but it's a glorification of that and just shits me to tears. Yeah. But what I got to admit, I'm reading this and I can't. On the one hand, reading it as me, I can't work out why this book is so popular. On the other hand, looking at it for what it is, I sort of can. But the thing is, like, it didn't seem that developed or... What am I trying to say? The world didn't seem that fleshed out.
Really?
The world's very allegorical.
Well, that's what I mean. The world seemed like a soundstage rather than a world. Mm. Which I suppose is fine because most of it actually happens in what amounts to a bubble.
Yeah.
But, that said, though, there was a couple of points in the books where actually it almost moved me to tears, like when the seed loaf turned up and stuff like that.
Yeah, that
like,
was a very nice way.
The ending, I'm not going to give anything away, but the ending of the whole three is just, it's...
But does the world get better developed throughout the other two books?
I think it does, but I think with Hunger Games, the world's functioning... It's funny because you mentioned 1984 and Brave New World before we were... recording. And I think both of those actually, they function on a level of allegory that the Hunger Games does really well, because a lot of the Hunger, if you actually sat down and broke it down, there's a lot of stuff which doesn't make that much sense in terms of if you were this kind of government with this kind of these challenges, is this the best way to do it? On the other hand, you know, this government's doing really crap things to their civilians. So. Yeah. But it because she's critiquing so many things in this book, a lot of the world-building functions as allegory. And especially in the last of the three, without giving anything away, the fact that in a lot of places it really does seem to go over the top, that actually just she treads this line where you almost fall off the edge and it's like, oh, that's way too much, that can't be happening. But because she's doing it, because she's taken it to such a heightened level of almost implausibility, it actually works. It feeds back into the allegory, and you realize you're not meant to be reading this thinking, oh, this is an actual fully realized, fully plausible world, sort of, you know, sort of like World War Z, I guess, was imagining. This is, you know, primarily allegory. And it's allegory for
and fundamentally
for
about
for
the haves,
teenagers.
About haves, the have-nots, about
social
freedom.
Divides. It's about a whole bunch of stuff.
All nice,
and
crunchy
that's what
stuff for 16-year-olds.
And it's really good. And she does a lot of, I think, fairly complicated things for the book. She has, I mean, which the first book doesn't get into as much. I think you really need to read the three, but if Katniss has really annoyed you and you don't care, then
No.
She is a first-person narrator, so you won't make it through three.
I think by the last third, I'm so into the survival aspect, and she is very clever, and she improvises, and she's not, you know, she's not an idiot. She's very empowered. She just could be a bit more secure, and she does become. To be fair to Suzanne Collins and the character, she does question. She does pose the questions that I'm thinking in my head about. Fuck it, snap out of it.
She does.
Yeah, and. So I suppose I've never read the Twilight books, but there's a genuine self-awareness on the part of A, the character, and B, the author.
No self-awareness in Bella.
Yeah, so I would easily read the next two books.
Yeah. As I said, she's got to go somewhere. She has three books. Yeah. She has to take Katniss somewhere. So she can't take her all the way in book one, and she's got to kind of leave her at a point where there's room to go.
But Cam's right. To do this properly as a movie, it's got to be rated, well, you know, in our terms, MA. I mean,
it'd be R, man.
No, not R. I mean, you don't...
You have children being stung to death by bees and swelling up into sacks of pus.
Yeah, that's true. That's actually
It depends how much they show on
Well,
camera.
This is the thing. I mean,
you have the main character who has to be killed by an arrow to the face after being mutilated by... You know what?
Rah.
Like, and what he gets
some
mutilated,
wolves,
even
yeah.
by itself, yeah. th- having to yeah. show that MA. That is hard horror.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's a young adult book.
I have a feeling they might be upping their age. The girl they've cast as Katniss is I can't remember the actress's name.
What was she in?
Damn it.
Looks like bigger than
someone's shouting at us right now with a name. But anyway.
Yeah. I think they might be upping the ages more towards
bullshit.
18 than...
That's bullshit.
No, the children are...
Ruth should be 12. Because if Ruth's not 12, it's
going to be
pointless.
I don't know.
You're attacking Kirsten.
I don't know.
How dare you make this point, Kirsten?
Sorry, I did. I know I should have cast it better.
And then she woke up.
So I don't know. Actually, that might be completely fallacious. I don't know.
Okay.
I'm just looking because Katniss is meant to be about...
Yeah, but what
16.
About Rue? The whole point of the Hunger Games, part of the horror of it, is the fact that you've got like five-year-olds or six-year-olds going in?
No, 12.
12 was the minimum.
12 to 18.
Yeah.
12 to 18. What,
but even so.
You missed that point, didn't you?
Yeah. 12 to 18.
It was the first book I read, so it's like three books
ago. 12 to 18 is high school. They're fucking vicious in high school. I wouldn't put it past any of them to be in the Hunger Games.
Yeah,
we're talking about high school kids. Come on. You're in high school?
Yeah.
I was in high school.
I wasn't fucking throwing spears at people at 12.
But I bet people were throwing spears at you.
I think they were.
There was this game we played. Anywho.
Snake.
Actually, some of it actually did sound like lunch break at St. Augustine's College. But
yeah, well, that I don't want to know about your childhood. is there anything else we want to say about Hunger Games?
No, I was really impressed. I was more impressed than I expected to be.
So was I.
So
this is one popular novel that we actually can say that, well, you have reservations, Cameron, but we can basically say we liked.
I liked it.
I just don't know if I'd go for the sequel. I probably would eventually, just not right now.
Mm. Yeah, well, I definitely don't have time, but anyway.
I've got to say that the first one you can kind of, I mean, like I said, I read it a few months ago and it took me this long to, and I only read the next two, because I kind of wanted to read the whole thing before this podcast.
So two and three are very close, as in
you wouldn't read Catching Fire and then go, oh, I can wait a few months. It's like, you finish Catching Fire and go, oh, Mockingjay.
But people did, though. I mean,
I know, but fortunately, I've started reading them well after they've all been published.
Tansy spoke about them glowingly on Galactic Suburbia.
I was very impressed. I was really, really impressed by the character
of Katniss.
No Excel
sheet. No Excel sheet. Okay. We're gonna end it there. We were going to talk about what Kat Sparks sent an email. It now feels like 4 years ago, about the Connie Willis book. You know what? That'll be perfect.
We're going to talk about it next
month. Because we're going to have to talk about Blackout and All Clear again anyway.
We love your feedback, and we're going to talk about it first next month. Is what we're going to do. We're going to make that our talking point.
No. But
yeah,
it
we are. Stop
to,
it.
No. Listen. Listen.
I promised it.
We're talking about the Hugo books next month, of which she's talking about one of the Hugo
exactly.
books.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. We'll make it a talking point.
All right. God, I hate it when we agree. We'd like you to please send feedback to the forum.
Oh, we've changed our website.
Yes. So oh, that's what... Can you let me read it out?
Okay, sorry.
We have changed our website. You can comment at the website, which is writer and critic. I'm not spelling that out. .podbean.com. So that's P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You should all know about Podbean. If you don't, where have you been? We left Posterous because it's shithouse.
Oh, because it was insufficient for our needs.
No, and because the customer service...
for other people's needs.
The customer service was... It felt like it was run by bots. And yeah, anyway, not great. Email is writerandcritic@gmail.com. So that's stay the same. And please give us 5 stars on iTunes.
Oh, give us whatever stars you feel.
Give us five. Do not go to... I've said this last time. Don't go to iTunes to give us 2 stars. That doesn't help me. And my ego doesn't survive those sort of things. So
next month.
Oh, next month.
August.
Which we don't
This
have
was your idea. Neither of us.
Is August episode 10?
Neither of us are nominating a book next month.
No, next month the, breaks the rules.
The collective wisdom of the Hugo nominating.
We have fucked it up a little bit in the sense that July 31st is when the votes have to be in. So actually our podcast... Well,
we're not
going to
influence people. We're not influencing people.
No, but I think next year we might do this podcast in July so that people can actually... Because I think we are influential.
Well, then we should possibly not.
Whatever. Anyway, so the books... We've already done Feed and... Black Hat and All Clear. We're not going to review Cryoburn by Bujold because it's part of the Vorkosigan saga. And
yeah, we haven't read them.
Well, so. I have. I've read most of them, but I haven't read the last three.
Okay.
And I can't be... I don't have the time.
Okay.
So if anyone actually... No, seriously, because I know, for example, Tansy's read Cryoburn. If anyone else has read Cryoburn and wants to provide comments... Sorry, let me cough here. Wow, that was loud.
Okay.
If anyone wants to provide comments that we can mention on the podcast, feel free. But the books we are going to read are The Dervish House by Ian MacDonald and The 100,000 Kingdoms by N.K. Jemisin,
yes.
Which I have now seen some very, very, very positive reviews of and some very, very negative reviews
of. I'm interested in reading them both. I've been avoiding reviews. Yes. I've been bookmarking them for later.
And I just want to mention Steph Gunn sent us a lovely email
very
a day or so
email.
Ago. She says you're funny, and she says that I'm brilliant. Actually, she didn't say that, but
I
she should
have. I think you imagined that inside your head.
I did, but Steph keeps sending those emails. We love them. And, before we thank Cameron, the other thing I want to mention was there's a website I want people to go. Actually, maybe I'll talk about this next month. No, I'll talk about it, but because it's actually a whole topic on its own,
yes,
and it can't really be done the last
so
2 months.
So professional.
No, why have you taken out a video camera, Cameron?
None of your business.
Oh, my God, you don't want me to strip again, do you?
I thought we got that out of the way before we recorded.
We did. All right, Cam, anyway, you've been wonderful. Seriously, look, I say this to all our guests, that they're the best guests we've ever had. You're not, but you've been great, though.
Thanks, Ian.
Yeah, you're a little bit worse than Felicity Dowker, so I probably shouldn't have said that. No, you've been great. You really have. You've been really talkative. You wouldn't answer my questions, but that's okay. And we really loved having you.
Oh, thanks, dude. It was fun.
Would you come again? Maybe not, you know, next week, but next month. would you do the show again?
I had a ball, and if you're willing to put up with me ranting, sure.
Well, when you the next book project, whatever, sees light of day, we might.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
That sounds like a plan.
Okay. All right. You got anything else to
you're
add?
You're a nasty man, Ian Mond.
That's not true. Have you got anything else to add? other than that?
No, that's pretty much my summation of the evening.
It's a bye-bye from me.
And I'm going to say goodbye as well.
See you guys. Bye.
See you next month. I looked at you.
I was told you two are professionals.
We're not.